Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Even as academics and alleged researchers, there's this way in which when we speak about racism, we want to separate racism from gender. And when we do that, we end up putting them back together, focusing almost exclusively on black female bodies. So we talk about intersectionality all the time. We need a race-gender analysis. But it seems that race-gender analysis never places black men at the helm of victimization through things that we think are feminine, are female violences like rape, domestic violence, domestic homicide, any of these types of things, violence by intimates, you know. So when this happens, people just say, ah, well, isolated incident. Ah, well, not the basis of black male experience. But then when you go back through history and you start digging just a little bit deeper than what those introductory textbooks that you get in Black Studies or Africana Studies 101 or Women and Gender Studies 101 tell you, you say, wow, you have black men like Richard Wright, black men like Eldridge Cleaver, right, people like Herndon, all trying to tell you that the basis of black male fear, phobia, and brutality has a sexual and homoerotic basis. This is phenomenal. Right? That every negrophobic white man, you know, thinks about performing, you know, thinks about receiving fellatio from the Negro, right? So this is well on the minds of black men writing during periods of Jim Crow, racist repression in the South, and colonization. But it skips the bourgeois black academic because it doesn't fit with a kind of post-civil rights notion of discrimination. Right, intersectionality, I was telling my class the other day, intersectionality only works if you assume that the segregationist basis of racism has fallen away, and you can only get a discriminatory basis, because you're talking about the ways in which identities play out in terms of recognition, and then how some people being recognized more than other people creates disparities, be it monetary, be it political, etc. But in a world where you're segregated because of your race, your identity only tells you the kinds of violence that have the propensity to accumulate around you. So it may be the case that if you're a black woman in Jim Crow, you're raped more often because that's the type of violence that white males in the South like to perpetuate against black women. That doesn't mean that black men aren't raped in the South. It just means that that's not the peculiar type of violence or the particular type of violence that they most often experience, right? And because we don't look at racism in that way as the articulation of various colonial and segregationist or Jim Crowish ideas, we completely miss the picture of this kind of brutality, despite the fact that this brutality happened over all across the world within various colonies. So we have a kind of dishonesty and short remembering, right? Because you have to remember that when America is colonizing the world, we're at the turn of the 20th century, right? We're only 60, 70 years out of that moment where people somehow became integrated, right? And we started adapting in the 1970s or late 80s these ideas of intersectionality. So these are at best, you know, 20, 30 years old. So the question we would have to ask ourselves is, how do theories that have just come about in the last 20 or 30 years do so much to reframe what we think is possible to bodies that we know have been existing, at least in the United States, in relationship to physical violence and sexual violence for at least the last two or three centuries? Right? It doesn't make any sense to read 300 years based on an innovation in the last 30. But nonetheless, that's what people do. And that's why they miss. That's why they erase. That's why they can't see this other component of racism, especially black male vulnerability. They just, you know, because under intersectionality, maleness has a privileged position. Now, post-intersectionality theories have certainly challenged that. You know, people like Matua, people like Darren Hutchinson, people like Angela Harris have certainly challenged that idea, right? Explain that black men experience a kind of gendered racism, and that police brutality is a great example of that kind of disproportionate disadvantage. And even, you know, Matua's piece I've talked about a few times, you know, where she's saying that once you really test for these alleged black male privileges, you can't really find them. At best, you'll talk about, you know, income disparities, but there's only a 4 to 6% or 6 cent income disparity if you're, you know, not taking consideration incarceration as your employment, and that translates to about a little less than $3,000 a year. So if you're going to base the disparities between genders on a notion of $3,000 a year, where that doesn't separate black men from black women in any substantial way because they live in the same neighborhood, same house, same danger, same violence, X, X, Y, and Z, then I really don't know what we're studying. You know, at some point we have to hold theories up to empirics. We have to go through and actually test what's going on. And in a world where we don't do that, we're kind of losing the point.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, November 22nd, 2016. So I have been told. Just a quick reminder, we will be here twice on Thursday. I suspect a lot of people will not have to work that day. You'll be doing whatever people do for the festivities, but we will be broadcasting. The early broadcast will be here at 4 p.m. In the afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific to take advantage of the day. Paul Ifeomi Grant will be here live from the United Kingdom. Good to have him back on the program. We'll talk about his piece, Why Most African Americans Deserve a Trump Presidency. That'll be the first program, and then the second broadcast. It's Thursday, so we always do workplace racism on Thursday. We don't take vacations from that. So tune in. We'll be looking forward 2 days away. The audio clip you heard at the beginning, Dr. Tommy Curry. He's been on the program numerous times over the years, and congratulations to him. He was just recommended for an award based on his outstanding scholarship that you got to hear a little bit of at the beginning of the program. Well-earned, job well done, Dr. Curry. But in that segment, he referenced our guest for today's broadcast. He's done quite a few times in terms of recommending other scholars that we should check out, have on the program. But when he was talking about intersectionality and how it applies to black males, the assumption that you have some sort of privilege, benefits as a black male in a system of patriarchy, and then upon further review, maybe that is not quite the case. Our guest for today's program, she's written about this quite a bit. We'll talk about some of her work, including Progressive Black Masculinities, as well as a report she wrote in 2013, Multidimensionality is to Masculinities What Intersectionality is to Feminism, which gets to the core of a lot of these issues and exactly what some of Dr. Curry presented at the beginning. Our guest for the evening, in addition to the reports I just read and various other articles, reports that she's published through the years, she is at the University at Buffalo. She is the Floyd H. and Hilda L. Hurst Faculty Scholar at their School of Law. Real pleasure to have her on the program. Joining us live, our guest, Professor Athena Matua. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Good to be here. Thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for speaking with us. Anything for our listeners? I'm sure this is some folks, this is their first time hearing from you. Anything that you think would be helpful to know about who you are, the work that you do?
I'm a lawyer by training. And I'm a law professor, so I teach law. And my areas of expertise are probably more generally civil rights, but specifically I'm a critical race scholar and also probably a feminist legal scholar. And I dabble recently in my most recent work on the issues around class, you know, kind of looking at this particular neoliberal moment and how that and the different economic theories, et cetera, really intersect with both race and gender. So I tend to look at kind of race, gender, and class in much of my recent work. A lot of my masculinities work, and it's been a while since I've done something on it. I started off with the Progressive Black Masculinities Project. And I think I started out with that in part because I had these three sons. And I was kind of really thinking, they were young. And I was kind of thinking, what kinds of experiences are they enduring? And will they endure? And, you know, will they have space to grow and flourish in our very kind of racist and also kind of gendered culture? And so I worked on that project with a lot of other prominent scholars, Mark Anthony Neal, Patricia Hill Collins, et cetera, to produce that book, and then went off to really try to develop what Curry calls this post-intersectionality theory. And some people call it a post-intersectionality theory. I consider it just an extension of the theory in many ways. And we were trying to really look at masculinities and masculinities kind of studies and theories and thinking about men and their experiences and how they live and how they perform their masculinity really required, at least given the theories that were available at that time, really required us to go a little bit beyond intersectionality, or at least it required me to go beyond intersectionality, because intersectionality was a theory that at that point looked primarily at women and women of color, the intersection of kind of race and gender, with gender really focusing on women. And it had a particular articulation that really came out of Morehouse at that time. That said, I think it's grown beyond that. But at that time, which said, okay, well, black men are privileged by race, are privileged, sorry, by gender and disadvantaged by race. That was the articulation. And when we looked into that, we found that that wasn't exactly true. And racial profiling really became our example of a situation that was kind of pervasive throughout our society, but one which happened primarily to black men, not to black women, not to the very bottom of the bottom when you talked about intersectional theory. And so we then had to go back and kind of look at masculinity's ideals and look at kind of cultural practices around men and around men of color, and then try to talk about kind of what was going on to men from this, you know, position of complexity, right? Their lives are complex. Their identities are multidimensional. Their identities are complicated, and they're not monolithic. And so we came up with this idea of multidimensionality. To talk generally about identities, but specifically to talk about the intersection of gender and race with a focus on men. So that's kind of where I went after Progressive Black Masculinities, always coming back to that initial work. So. Does that help?
That helps a lot. I'm sure we'll have more questions, listeners, myself, as we proceed. But that's a great opening. For listeners who have not seen you, you can go to her faculty page at the University at Buffalo. You are a black female. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right on.
Yeah.
This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms, racism, white supremacy, as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that's an accurate definition?
Yes, that system definitely exists. and it is a global system. It was a global system from the beginning. I use a slightly different definition, but it gets at the same sort of idea. And I'm trying to think about it. I think about white supremacy as being ultimately about a system whereby whites primarily, that works in favor of whites, to maintain its monopoly over resources, this nation's resources and other nations' resources, opportunities, levers of power, policies, and empathetic concern. It's a system that is about kind of grabbing the resources in the nation, in the world, primarily for the use by white people, and particularly white elites. That's kind of how I come at it. And what that means is that you have to subjugate everybody else. And they've developed elaborate systems and elaborate cultural beliefs to justify why they should own and control the world's resources and why everybody else should not. So blacks are this and Latinos are that and Asian Americans are something other. That sort of thinking, huge kind of ideologies about what those people are, which justifies them as the superior race, monopolizing all of these resources and trying to maintain those resources. So the Trump election is really about a move to try to maintain control, maintain the monopoly over these resources, over power, over policy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So very similar, I think, but the motivation might be a little bit different, I think.
Okay. I wanted to, before I get, because I definitely want to get some of your thoughts on the election to touch more on that, but we have been talking quite a bit, it seems, for quite a long time about Kent Thompson, former prosecutor in Brooklyn, New York. You, as a legal scholar in the New York area, I was, you know, very eager to hear your opinion on his tenure as a prosecutor in Brooklyn, just your thoughts on what he accomplished.
Well, you know what? I don't really know that much about him. You probably know more about him than I do. I'm in Western New York, in Buffalo, on the other side of the state. And so Buffalo has the feel more of the Midwest than it does in some ways of the East Coast. So very kind of a different sort of politics. And so my knowledge about kind of what's going on in the city and the different personalities is limited. But what I do know about him from kind of reputation is simply that, you know, he went into the office as DA with an idea to try to weed out the inequalities in the criminal justice system, that he was interested in establishing some sort of racial equality. That's a really big goal when you talk about the criminal justice system, which is kind of corrupt from beginning to end, from the bottom up all the way up to the top. And so he went in there really trying to think about fairness and how to use his position in that office in a way to promote a notion of equal justice. And so that's what I know of him. So he did that in a couple of different ways. One, he stopped the, he really stopped trying to have nonviolent offenders of certain drug laws. He really tried to stop prosecuting those and leaving that whole group of people, mostly young people, mostly males, but increasingly women who get caught up in that system. He really tried to stop that practice, and that's a practice that at least some allege has really fueled mass incarceration. So he had a real agenda about that. And also, I guess the second thing that kind of occurs to me about his reputation, because I only know him by reputation, is his inclination to to go after police, to really take an interest in police brutality and really try to do something about that. And I think that's unusual. I think that when we look at prosecutors kind of around the country, they are increasingly coming under fire. We've always known that they were part of the problem when we talk about police brutality. We always knew they were part of the problem when we talk about mass incarceration. We knew they were part of the problem. We know that lots of studies been done on it, that the incentives in place really encourage prosecutors to, one, on the one hand, dealing with mass incarceration, to turn bodies out through plea bargaining. And in terms of police brutality, prosecutors work with the police and they work closely with the police. And so even where you have some sort of an egregious crime, they are reluctant to bring those cases. And even when they bring them, juries are reluctant to convict police who have been charged with brutality, even if we have it on film. They're reluctant to do that. And so Ken comes in with some concrete ideas, because he was also a federal prosecutor. He came in with some concrete ideas about how to disrupt those discretionary processes, how to disrupt those processes, and which appeared to be fairly successful. But past that, I don't know any more than others who kind of are looking at him from afar. And my assumption is there are others who know him personally and have a much more grounded view of what he thought and, you know, what he did specifically in specific circumstances. So can't say that much about it. But certainly a different kind of personality in that kind of office where there are so many problems. So it's unfortunate that we've lost him at such a young age.
Shame.
It's sad. It's tragic, yeah.
Absolutely. I appreciate you, you know, just, hey, Buffalo is not New York City. You know, it's not quite in your immediate area, and, you know, just kind of what you've read in the newspaper kind of thing, or just heard in passing following the news and what have you. Not an expert. Definitely appreciate that. I was asking just, I wasn't sure if you had followed him that closely or not, because a lot of our, or I won't say a lot, but a significant number of our listeners were critical of Ken Thompson because of his involvement in the Akai Gurley case, the black male who was shot and killed towards the end of 2014. They did convict the officer, Peter Liang, who's an Asian American male, non-white male. Mm-hmm. He was convicted, but he got no jail time. And Ken Thompson specifically, even though he did get the conviction, he recommended no jail time, which and a lot of people were very upset about that and saying that, you know, this is just another example of a corrupt justice system that does not value black life. They were upset about that. And there was, in fact, there was even a report in the Village Voice this month by Nick Pinto, where he was saying that there was a big case where there were a lot of exclusively black people were being arrested for gun charges by a group of officers. And the judges ultimately concluded that their testimony was not credible. He used the term incredible specifically. And Ken Thompson did not indict. His office had prosecuted with some of these officers' testimony. There was criminal. It's a complicated thing, but the end of it is there were a lot of black people exclusively being prosecuted for gun charges that are suspicious enough that judges ultimately concluded that they did not believe these officers, and Ken Thompson's office didn't seem interested in reviewing these cases. But at any rate, since you haven't checked it, I did just want to ask, you kind of got my attention. I have been focusing on the word discretion in various ways as it applies to racism, white supremacy. Just as a legal scholar, can you talk about the various ways that discretion ends up impacting the experience that black people have in with regards to law?
There are lots of literature out there on it, but what everybody knows, right? So the first level of discretion is who you stop, right? Police have that discretion. Who you stop, supposedly, they are not supposed to stop you unless they have some sort of probable cause. But probable cause can be anything. So you've got a broken taillight, they can stop you. They get to the car window. They see something, they smell something, or they claim to see something or smell something, then they have, you know, kind of more discretion to probe further. We get caught up right there. There's a lot more, police stop us more often. They frisk us more often. They, outright search us more often, search our cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have that kind of discretion, and supposedly it is bounded by law. But when you look at a kind of a host of Supreme Court cases, you find that those boundaries are very fluid, very fluid. And it's easy to justify stopping a person, frisking a person, searching a person. Generally, the ideal is as you become more intrusive in your search of a person and his or her property, you have to have kind of more reason for doing that. But in practice, it really just doesn't translate that. They have a lot more discretion, and the courts defer to them. They are the ones who have the knowledge. They have the experience. They know, so the court, this is court talk, Supreme Court talk, in fact. They have the experience. We're trusting their judgment, and so they have a lot of discretion there. More specifically, when we talk about discretion, we really talk about it at the level of whether or not to prosecute a case. And prosecutors have wide discretion about whether or not they should prosecute a case or not. And what we find is that where people of color are involved, or Black people are involved in particular, they often choose to pursue those cases a lot more often than they do when the offenders are white. So just the discretion to bring the case or not. And then you have and there's two other little pieces in there that I just kind of want to throw in that relate, are not specifically about discretion, but certainly relate to it. And that is, if a person has been brought into custody or arrested, for something, there's a general practice about how you charge them, still at the police. How do you charge them? And the practice has been, to kind of throw everything at them. So a lot of times when you see charges against almost any person of color, it's not usually one charge, it's usually three or four charges. There's a practice of overcharging offenders of certain laws, or people who are just suspicious. The police suspect that they have done something, or they have done something minor. What you find is kind of a whole list of charges, very problematic. And as a former prosecutor once told me quite honestly, oh yes, we just list any number of charges, anything that's related that we think might stick. And that becomes really problematic if these things go to trial, but they also become very problematic if there's some sort of plea deal that is structured, because then the prosecutors who, one, have the discretion to bring a case or not, but two, in this instance, they have a whole list of charges with which to sort of pressure you. It's not sort of pressure, to pressure you to plead out a case. So you were jaywalking, but policeman approached you, and then you're charged with jaywalking, obstruction of justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You've got three or four charges. Then the prosecutor, who has the discretion to bring a case or not, has decided to bring a case. And then they say, well, you've got these four charges. We can, in fact, if you go to trial, we're going to ask the court that you serve 15 years, or we're going to try to get you on kind of all of these charges, much of which is kind of just garbage that the police kind of lined up, a very typical practice that the police basically just kind of added to some sort of encounter that they had with you. And so then you're in a position where you may have done something wrong, or you may be caught in some sort of weird circumstances. You have not kind of one charge, but three or four charges against you. You have a prosecutor who has decided, who has discretion to bring a case or not, can throw it out, but a lot of times does not. And now the prosecutor is saying, okay, unless you plead to these this charge, or unless you plead to this set of circumstances, if you decide to go to trial, we're gonna try you on all of these charges, which will yield a sentence of 15 years. When if you take the plea, it's going to be 2 years. So a lot of discretion there, a lot of choices that prosecutors can make. That becomes really problematic, and at every level of those. So studies suggest at every level of that process and beyond, you've got a discretion and you've got discriminatory discretion. That is that when we look at what happens to, when we look at the numbers of people of color who get kind of ground up in that system as compared to whites, we find that we're disproportionately harmed by that discretion. So that's a real problem that a study suggests exists throughout the criminal justice system. I raised that issue with regard to something else. Can't remember what it was, but that's the problem that we see in the criminal justice system, and it's just one of many.
Wow. Again, from the University at Buffalo School of Law, Professor Athena Matua. Am I saying it correctly, Matua?
Mature, yes, exactly.
Just making sure. Mm-hmm. Really, really appreciate that, because my eyes light up, or my ears, every time I hear that word. I know WNYC in New York, they did a great report last year talking about discretion, even from the side of prosecutors' issues, so eloquently laid out. They highlighted the fact that you have very, 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 very few black prosecutors in the U.S. to begin with. And so then you add all that discretion in there. There are very few black people are in the position to make these decisions. And they had a black female prosecutor on, and she talked about how she remembered a case. It was a white woman, really horrific child abuse case. They had, as you just said, they used discretion. They didn't charge her. This black female prosecutor mm-hmm. came in and said, why is she not being charged? This is a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. What is the issue? And she told mm-hmm. her boss, I think it's racism. And different way, I think it's racism that this white woman is not being charged. If this was a black person, they would have been charged eons ago. We would have been done with this case. Mm-hmm. And she went ahead, prosecuted. Mm-hmm. She said she got a very, very easy conviction on this case. But that's another way that it plays out. And even the case from this past weekend, they were talking about cannabis legalization in California, and they were saying that one of the things that was changed is that now if you are convicted multiple times in the state of California, if you're convicted multiple times of selling cannabis without a license, it's a misdemeanor. But after, I think it's the third or fourth infraction, it becomes what they call a wobbler. And they have the discretion to bump that up to a felony if you continue, even now in California, post legalization. But the quick question that I wanted to ask, just your thoughts as a legal scholar, what's your legal recommendation or opinion on motorists when they're in a vehicle, they're stopped by an enforcement officer, the officer asks to search their vehicle without a warrant? Just your legal opinion, should motorists consent to that search?
No. No, and they should ask the officer, what they've been stopped for. Officer, what am I being stopped for? And if they ask, we'd like to search your vehicle, the answer should be, no, I don't think that's necessary. I don't really want to consent to your searching my vehicle. And after that, you have to start playing it by ear, right? Yeah, continue the conversation. What am I stopped? Are you charging me with something? What have I done wrong? That sort of kind of conversation, but straight, short kind of answers. No, I do not want my vehicle searched. Why are you stopping me? Do you have probable cause for stopping me? Do you have probable cause for a search? Those are really complicated languages. There are all kinds of institutions now that are really coming up with what I think is a nice script. And I'd have to look at those for both motorists and pedestrians who are engaged, who are stopped by police. The nice script of kind of what you say and how you say it. Most people are not going to say, do you have probable cause? Right? So there's better language. But you can certainly refuse to have your car searched, just like you can refuse to have your personhood searched, unless they're arresting you for something.
Mm.
And so those in New York City actually has some great stuff, some great scripts that are online and on the internet that were developed in the first instance for stop and frisk incidences. And they were produced for young people, so they're in simple language and are kind of direct and can kind of convey to the police officer that you have some sense of kind of what your rights are and kind of know what you're talking about. But let's be clear. We've seen some horrific incidences where people have been cooperative, who have been clear about what they were doing, and they still ended up killed or seriously injured. We have seen this. And so in some ways, you're not guaranteed a successful encounter, kind of no matter what you do, right? So we've seen these horrific videos where a man's on the ground who's a psychologist or psychiatrist with his hands up, and he was shot. We heard about the incident, I believe it was in Minnesota, where the gentleman says, you know, I have a license for a gun, and the officer instructs him to do something. He's reaching over to get his license, et cetera, and he is shot. So I think we have to be really careful about how we engage police. And I do think we have to speak in kind of simple language. We have to be clear. We have to be calm, because at the end of the day, we want to live to fight another day.
Amen.
And, you know, we want to live. I have three sons. I want them to live to fight another day. And so I think, and it's, sometimes that's hard for my sons to hear, because it sounds, they think that's really unfair, right? We all do. We think that's really unfair. We think that police officers are here to serve us. Now, that may or may not be true, but that's what we think, and that's what they should be here to do, to serve and protect. And if we've been engaged in some sort of violation, they should treat us with respect. And if they, in their engagement with us, if we, you know, they ask us a question, we should answer. If they are asking to come into our homes, to search our cars, and we refuse, they should respect that, unless they're arresting us. But that's not always the case. And that seems really unfair to at least my sons, who then want to, who are very expressive. And I say to them, well, here's a script. Be very clear, be very calm, be very certain about what you're doing, but also gauge the situation, because you want to live to fight another day. Mm. Get his badge number, get his name, and, you know, be calm and, you know, kind of go with the program, which is not great advice, but which I think is great advice, but is not satisfying to them when they think they're being dealt with in a way that's unfair and that's unjust. But what do? This is where we live in.
Absolutely. Got to be honest about that context of white supremacy. That is what we are addressing. And I just appreciate that as I get to my next question, because as you were giving your response, I wanted to almost say, hang on a second, Professor Matua, as opposed to getting the legal scholar, like you answering this as a legal sponsor, let's get this answer as a black mother to the consent. And you did that naturally within the question, just absolutely brilliant. You were talking about the being stopped and searched and the discretion that enforcement officials have going out and about, and how that impacts the system of racism, white supremacy. Our president-elect, Donald Trump, that was part of his campaign. Stop and frisk works. We need to do more of it across the country to help address the problem of crime. You, in fact, in your 2011 speech at the LatCrit 14th Annual Conference, this was 2011, you were saying that there was a lot of rhetoric about building a wall, and you said that what we're seeing is patriotism wrapped in whiteness. This is 2011, and now we have Donald Trump. What are your thoughts?
Patriotism wrapped in whiteness. I didn't even remember that.
Great line. You should use it again.
5 years ago. Okay. Well, that's what we have. I mean, I certainly see the election as an attempt to maintain white supremacy. I mean, I think you're absolutely correct about that. I think we've got an electorate that is really terrified about the browning of America. We've got at least a significant part, not all, but a significant part of the electorate that was appalled by the audacity of a black president. And we have at least a significant segment of the electorate, or maybe a smaller segment, that is also under some economic distress. But we have been under economic distress for 300 or 400 years. So, but you have all of that there. And Donald Trump really appealed to all of that. He appealed to their fears about the browning of America. And how might you be able to keep America white, right? Make it gray again, make it white again? Well, at least get rid of some of these brown bodies who are undocumented. That's one way. Let's stop this immigration from certain countries, or limit this immigration from certain countries, and really bring in more Europeans, because that's kind of what we like. That is one way that you do that. And it's not just Mexican-Americans or Latinos more broadly. There are a lot of African immigrants. There are a lot of course, Asian immigrants. There are, in fact, not just immigrants, but undocumented immigrants. There used to be, and I assume there still are, a good population, at least in the Massachusetts area, of undocumented Irish immigrants. But they are not the target of this type of thinking and this focus. The building of a wall is not about Canadians who are coming over and are undocumented. It's really about those Mexican Americans and other folks like them, the browner folks who are coming from the South, that these folks are finding so, so problematic. This wall idea strikes me as ridiculous, and I think Americans should be committed to hindering that effort. But there certainly is a large segment of the population who are very concerned about this immigration of Latinos into the country, which I think are contributing to the browning of America, at least from their perspective. Now, the reality is that, at least with regard to Mexican Americans, that, and I'm talking about Americans in a much larger sense, both North and South America, the immigration numbers are reversing. They're really low right now. Because the economy has been so poor that you don't have the large number of Mexicans and Mexican Americans coming into the United States at this point. So the immigration flag waving is kind of false at this moment. So there were large numbers of there was a large amount of immigration from Mexico over a period of years, but that has since declined. Things are stagnant right now, or even in reverse order, more leaving than coming. The numbers are in decline. And so a lot of this churning about immigration is not even real at this moment. There's not a flood of these brown people coming into the country at this moment. But that was certainly a big issue among the segment of the population that voted for Donald Trump. Immigration was a big issue. I think there were other issues, but that was a big one.
What do you make? There was so much talk leading up to the election about, oh my goodness, there's no way we can have Donald Trump in office. The comments that he's made about women, he's an open misogynist and a sexist, and his treatment of female journalists, even Fox's Megyn Kelly and what have you. And then, according to numerous reports, 53% of white women voters supported Donald Trump. What do you make of that seeming contradiction?
Yeah, that's why the election is so disappointing. Not surprising. Not surprising for, I think, those of us who recognize that America's a beautiful is really quite racist, right? That racism is pervasive in the United States, and that white supremacy is the standing order, right? Is the political system. Racism is the foundation of the pillar of the society. White supremacy is a foundational pillar of the society, and racism is pervasive. So for some of us, it was not surprising. That didn't stop me, for one, from being really, really angry about that, that's the way it turned out, that, in fact, the election to me sent this message that some of us are unwelcomed, in fact, a lot of us are unwelcome, and that a lot of us should be uncomfortable. So Muslims are not welcomed, Latinos are not welcomed, and they'll tolerate other peoples of color, but only tolerated them. So a very, just a very kind of sad and enraging, I think, election. It sent a message of exclusion to all of us, to kind of all people of color, even Native Americans, I think. With white women in particular, that was also enraging, at least personally for me. Especially if you will recall, when Barack Obama was elected president, there was so much hand-wringing and so much anger on the part of white women that Hillary Clinton had lost to Barack Obama. okay, so Barack Obama's out of the way. We're all supporting Hillary Clinton. I started off as a Sanders supporter myself and then moved to a Hillary supporter. And then you get these results, and what you find is kind of up and down both the educational and the economic levels white women voted for Trump, kind of overwhelmingly. He did take women with a college education. Hillary took those 51 to something like 48, but it was really close. And he took the majority of kind of white women. Trump took the majority of white women in all the other kind of categories. My reaction, though, ultimately, is that white women have never been reliable allies, except for feminists, and even white feminists, and even that is a struggle. That has always been a fight. There have always been internal fights when we talk about feminism, and when you talk about white feminism and feminism, black feminists, or other feminists of color. There's always been a struggle. There's always been a fight about white women kind of centering themselves and their experiences. That has been a real problem in the feminist movement with those of us who consider ourselves feminists. Yet I think that feminism did a good job of changing or having a real impact on the culture. So, when I used to take my boys to Taekwondo, there were a lot of little girls in Taekwondo. There are a lot of girls kind of across the races being educated and promoted. And I think that is really a tribute to feminism. But you will remember when we talk about the early years of feminism in the early 1900s, as soon as, I've got a history of this, so as soon as black men were given the right to vote, we saw the racism erupt among the white feminists then. Since then, it's just been a struggle. But I talk about three groups. I tend to talk about feminists, white women, and then I usually talk about skanks.
Wow.
Terrible.
What a scholarly term. Wow, I'm going to write that down.
It's terrible. That's a function of anger. Because I think that they have always been unreliable. So we can go back and we can talk about the early 1900s and white feminists kind of turn against any kind of coalition that might have existed between blacks and the abolition movement and that sort of stuff and white women. They kind of turn on the dime when black men are allowed to vote and white women have to continue struggling, or women in general have to keep struggling for the vote. But we've seen it in recent times as well. So I can recall back when California was voting on the affirmative action. And what proposition was that? There were two of them. One was 187. That might have been about Can't remember. But this they were voting on one of the propositions that had to do with affirmative action. And the vote, what was very interesting about the vote was that something like 75% of Latinos voted in favor of affirmative action. Black people voted in favor of very large numbers of for affirmative action. And even Asian Americans had voted in very high numbers for affirmative action. And when we looked at what was problematic in that election, it was really white women are the ones who had voted against affirmative action. Now, here we have a group of people who have benefited the most affirmative action. So we think about affirmative action really being designed to address the inequities that Black people in particular have faced in this society. But the overwhelming beneficiaries of that have not been Black people. It has been white women. And so we come to one of these state votes, one of these referendums on affirmative action, and this might have, maybe it wasn't a state proposition, might have been a city proposition, and the proposition goes down in defeat primarily because white women, the beneficiaries of it, the major beneficiaries, don't support it. And so it seems to me we see this thing over and over again where white women, you know, even though we have these views and we get this message that white women are more sympathetic toward anti-racist struggle, that they are more sympathetic and in agreement with economic policies that try to address structural inequities that result in poverty, more poverty for people of color than for whites, but poverty all around. We hear this rhetoric about white women being doing something quite different from white men who kind of get written off perhaps unfairly, but large sections of them are really kind of in support of white supremacy, white male supremacy, white women doing something very different. But from my perspective, when we look at history, and I have to think about more examples, white women are not the most reliable allies that we have. And I think that is for a lot of complicated reasons, but a lot of times we cannot count on them. And as we see in this election, we couldn't count on them again this time. And there was all of this rhetoric about women in particular, but that women generally, but white women in particular, supporting Hillary Clinton. And that just didn't pan out. And it didn't pan out in the context of an election where all of those things that you talked about happened. You know, this is a man who insulted every other group out there, every other, and this is important, vulnerable group out there, undocumented immigrants, Muslims, Black folks, the disabled, you know, really just disregarded the humanity of the people that constitute these different groups. And white women abandoned that. So, you know, from my perspective, we've got this racist, sexist person who is out there kind of flaming, fanning the flames of this divisiveness and hatred. And these women support that. They for whatever reason, there is a vote for oppression and discrimination and inequality. Whether, you know, and sometimes they brush it off. We didn't think, we don't think, we think it'd be different, whatever. But really a vote for this kind of racist, sexist rhetoric and belief system. And they're nowhere to be found. Really, really problematic, I think. And so very disappointed, but I'm not so sure they've ever been reliable allies. From our perspective, from the perspective of kind of anti-racism, I'm just not so sure they've been as a large group, not as individuals, as a group, if they've really been good allies, if we look over the historical period. And then there's this last group, I think, that really kind of is really kind of opportunistic. And I don't know how I'm really kind of separating them out, but that's really opportunistic. And I see them, I guess, when I think of people like Fisher, Abigail Fisher. And if you recall, she was the one who brought the suit at the University of Texas, challenging their admissions policy, which had a race-conscious component to it. And Abigail Fisher's a young people. I give all young people a pass. You know, I'm an educator, and I think young people are our future. And so generally, my thought is there's hope for them, like their energy. But she's an example of someone who I just think is opportunistic. It will be interesting as she matures to see if she fights for anything while reaping the benefits of, on the one hand, white supremacy, and on the other, any advantage that is gained by other struggles. And then, so not only reaping all of those benefits, but then kind of comes back and really challenges systems because she personally didn't benefit. She, you know, this is a system that's put in place to address inequities in the system. And because she didn't get admitted, then she challenges those policies. Not that those policies had some direct effect on her. Admissions is no one's entitled to be admitted to any place. And I've done admissions, right? And that is a complicated process where you've got lots of applications, you've got lots of people who are qualified. And at some point you are looking at a bunch of different factors and admitting people. Not entitled, but she decides that she didn't gain admissions because of this policy, because somebody else gained admission and because they were black or whatever. And so that just, the opportunism of it all, I find very, very disturbing. So those folks you really can't count on. Those are the ones I think I'm referring to as the skanks, although she's too young to really be one. Isn't that terrible? That's a terrible thing to say. That's a product of anger. I shouldn't say that on the radio. But I've written it, you know, kind of white feminists, white women, and skanks. This sort of thing. So anyway, the election, I think, in that regard, was very, very disappointing for me as a woman and as a feminist. And as, you know, when you think about black women, and this was, Hillary is a white woman. African-American women came out. We were her biggest supporters. We came out at the level of, what, 93%? 92-93% of us who voted supported Hillary Clinton. And they didn't even support kind of one of their own who was addressing, not just that she was a woman, but she was actually addressing some of the things that I think feminists have been arguing for, that they have been advocating for, looking at kind of the lives of women and what they need in their seasons and how the society is actually structured to limit their own potential. She was addressing some of those policies, and yet they voted for Trump, who really had a message of hate and exclusion. Yeah. Cool. Not surprising, but disappointing.
Adding that to my counter-racist lexicon, skank, new term, moving forward, I will employ that liberally, but I definitely...
Don't do that. Don't do that.
I will cite Professor Matua moving forward. That will be my scholarly term. But I definitely think the 2016 presidential election, at least for me, this will be a watershed moment in terms of a referendum on white women and their commitment in terms their priorities. I would put it that way in terms of what they prioritize. To me, this was a clear demonstration. White supremacy is priority one. Everything else is a way distant second, third, wherever it else second. Is on the list. And it's way, way back, not even close. What's your opinion? Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's really interesting. So, you know, and people are diagnosing this differently. Some folks have argued that the real problem is that Hillary Clinton, as a person and as a candidate, did not address what they're arguing were the economic issues that working class women faced. One, I'm not so sure that's accurate if you actually looked at her policies, but they were certainly captivated. They certainly seem to have been captivated by the Trump's rhetoric and this rhetoric of exclusion. Others have argued that, you know, white women still see kind of white men as their saviors. And I think that really plays into your idea of, you know, so their priority is white supremacy. They are white women. They are white. And white racism is pervasive, and they are not excluded from that. Where I am more sympathetic is with regard to children, right? So one of the things that got discussed in this California example I was giving you, and I wish I had looked that one up, was that white women, I think, like all families, not just women, but families, you know, think about their children and think about their children's future. And at the end of the day, that those white women decided that they, you know, that affirmative action from their point of view had a negative effect on their children, that their children would not be, would not have the same access that they wanted them to have if they really had to compete with all of these other groups of color. And so a little sympathetic about that, but that's all. But that's still about white privilege, isn't it? Still about monopolizing the resources for ourselves to the exclusion of others. We are the only ones entitled to a decent life. If there's some resources left over for the rest of you, fine. But we're the ones who are entitled to that, and our children are entitled to that. So, problematic.
Absolutely. I guess the my assessment in terms of young white children, I don't have that sympathy, I guess, or giving them the benefit of the doubt. Number one, we've had many whites on the program, and I ask them, does it make logical sense, given everything that has happened for centuries, for victims of racism to give white people the benefit of the doubt in any matters concerning mm-hmm. racism? And they've overwhelmingly said no. So I stick to that. But mm-hmm. with younger whites, I've concluded that their white parents, mothers and fathers and grandpa and grandma and aunts and uncles, they all do a phenomenal job of transferring that racial inheritance about what is expected of you as a white man, as a white woman in the society. And I've seen too many illustrations that they understand that at a very young age. And by the time they are, I don't know exactly where, but it's early. I think it's much earlier than many non-white people think. They understand very well what racism is, what their role is going to be as a white woman, as a white man, and how they are supposed to think and treat black people. I think they have a very sophisticated... Go ahead.
Oh, of course they do. Of course they do, without a doubt. So all you have to do is pull out the white and black doll test, right? And so when I listen to adults debate whether racism exists, which has been the debate up until now, particularly during the Obama years, right? It's been this kind of fake notion about post-racialism and post-racial society. But I always simply responded, particularly to the adult, since I'm an educator, I actually make an argument and teach something different in the classroom, because I think that young people can change, and at the ages even of 20, 23, 25, that they are, this is a time, this is one hopes you do it earlier than that, but this is a moment where they're really kind of grappling with some things, and this is a time when you can really introduce critical thinking along some very tough issues. And so I always hold out hope for them. But you're absolutely correct that when I'm talking to adults, I'll say, oh, yes, our 5-year-olds can tell us what we are teaching them. they may not be able to articulate that this is racism and this is what I'm being taught. But one of the things that famous doll test that's now been repeated, I think CNN redid the test a couple of years ago, where they line up the white dolls and the black dolls and that sort of stuff. And then they bring in these different children, white children, black children, Latino children, and ask them to choose who's the smartest, who's the most beautiful, who's stupid, who's bad. Our five-year-olds can tell us what we are teaching them. So yes, we get this very early. We start getting it at age two, if not before. By five, we know what the script is. Sit down any, you know, kind of group of five-year-olds of different races, and they'll tell you, this is what, in my 5 years of life, I've learned about my society. So when I hear adults talking about debating this, I just have to kind of sit back and not really engage it, because I think that if a five-year-old can get it, you at 45, you know, debating whether it even exists is willful ignorance or willful blindness to the realities of the society. This is what we teach our children, and they know it by five or six. My children knew it by five or six. They knew they were not the chosen ones. This is not hard stuff, not rocket science. So I agree with you. White youth know their role. And they certainly, so by the time I get them at 23, 24, they've known it since they were, you know, 3, 4, and 5. It's deeply ingrained. And part of the challenge, I think, when you're teaching courses about race, or that touch on race, and you start talking about the social construction of race, and you start talking about the way it has divided, that is embedded in all of our institutions and embedded in our psyche, part of what you're doing is revealing that reality to them. Because not only have they learned the code, they've learned to be blind to the code, to the structure. And so you have to reveal it to them. You have to bring it out of them because they know it. So I have an exercise where, and I think a lot of educators use this exercise, where I put up all the, put up on the board blacks, Native Americans, whites, middle class, poor, gay men, or LGBTQ+, and put up those lists. And I say, tell me the stereotypes about it. And they're reluctant at first because they don't really want to say it out loud. And I say, well, if you can't say it here, how are you ever going to engage it in the real world? Tell me what you know. And before the hour is up, I have a board full of stereotypes. And then I turn around and I say, well, how do you know that? Where did it come from? I didn't tell you these. I didn't give it to you. I didn't say it. You named all of this stuff. So how do you know it? Where'd you get it from? Where does it come from? And so it's a process of revealing to them what they already know, because they've known it all of their lives. Now, if you haven't thought about it before, if you didn't get some of it in junior high school, if you didn't get some of it in high school, if you haven't started unappealing this piece of fruit in college, let's do it now. And then let's think about how we get this stuff, where it comes from, what it really is, and what are its goals and its modus operandi, and how does it get embedded into our institutions, and how does it get embedded into our psyche, and then how do we, what do we do about it, right? So I agree with you. That was a long explanation. I'm sorry to agree with you that, oh, yes, they know it. But I guess since I'm an educator, I just have not given up on them at this point. And I think, that's a good thing. And I think I see a lot of promise in the youth, even though, let's be clear, in terms of white youth, Trump won that group too. Let's be clear.
That's very important to keep that in mind as well, in my opinion. Context of White Supremacy, legal scholar from University at Buffalo, Professor Athena Matua. When you use the term privilege in a racial context, what do you mean when you say privilege?
Let me give you an example in this election. a privilege. So, and I gave this talk quite recently. In the bubble that I live in, there was a lot of back and forth. The question was, were the people who voted for Trump, are the people who voted for Trump racist? It was the question, just how it got posed in a lot of different kinds of ways. And one of the responses I think that a lot of us got from white liberals, from a lot of whom are our friends and allies, was that, well, some people wanted to, they weren't really racist. They really wanted to just shake things up. And in fact, they are people who voted for Obama in the last election. And my response was, and I think a lot of our responses, but my response was, well, that's kind of white privilege, you know, to vote for Obama in the last election and then vote for this racist man this election. So Obama last election, vote for this racist man, this man engaged in all of this exclusive and mean-spirited rhetoric. That's privilege. Because I don't think that Muslims, that many Latinos, that many Black folks thought they could really take that risk just to shake things up, you know? That's privilege. That's the privilege of all of that rhetoric being, you know, being not targeted toward you. So nobody's threatening deportation of you. Nobody's threatening to have you go and register at some national registry. Why? So they can put that yellow star on your chest? Nobody is targeting you or your children. Your children are being routinely shot down in the streets. So you have the privilege of whiteness. You have the benefit of that. You're not the target of any of this stuff. So you can declare that you're not a racist and you voted for Obama last time, but you voted for Trump this time just because you wanted to shake things up. Well, we didn't have that luxury. Let's be much more pragmatic about that. That's privilege. That's an example of privilege, of white privilege, not to be the target of all of that kind of stuff. And to just kind of take the risk of voting for someone who has been very clear about what he thinks of all these other different groups, except yours, and what he's going to do in terms of excluding them from the society or promoting policies that are geared toward subordinating them. So for us, the stop and frisk policy, a policy that lots of studies have shown, in New York in particular, where it was kind of official policy, that it didn't work. It's a waste of resources. It alienated the community. The, you know, in terms of stops, African Americans were stopped a great deal more often than whites. And generally, they found nothing. I can't remember what the percentages were, but they found nothing. So they stopped and harassed, police stopped and harassed all of these people, alienated all of these people with minimum or no return. Privilege not to have to really be subject to that. That's the benefit of being white in a white supremacist society.
With the example that you provided, and I guess even because I do on the program, I prompt about in terms of examples, in terms of just getting specific definitions. I do prompt about that on the program because I found that it can be problematic sometimes when people substitute examples for definitions that you can sometimes have difficulty really grasping what the concept means. Just do you have a concise, you know, this is what I mean when I say privilege that's not an example?
That's not an example. Oh, I thought that was a good example. Okay, not a good example.
Oh, it is. I'm just so that I can boil it down to, yeah, to get so, like a definition.
So how would I define privilege?
Right.
That's a tougher one. I should know that kind of by heart. Privilege is having the white privilege, the male privilege or whatever. But white privilege is having the benefits of domination, right? Having access to the benefits of domination. That's a short and concise. Does that tell you anything, though?
Access to the benefits of domination. For me, it does. It's very helpful. Thank you for indulging me, because I wanted to ask. I've been to the White Privilege Conference. We've had Dr. Peggy McIntosh as a guest on this program, and many others.
Yes.
And I question this at the White Privilege Conference. If what we're talking about is, I mean, power, access to the benefits of domination, where we can decide as whites, we can decide we're going to use our quote unquote white privilege to put Donald Trump in the White House. So we're going to use our white privilege to put, you know, policing laws in place where we know we can already predict that black people, whole generations of them are going, you know, greater confinement, mm-hmm. school to prison. We already know that these things are going to happen. If that's what we're talking about, in my view, it is not the most accurate description. If that's what this is, calling that privilege, mm-hmm. to me, it very much makes it a much more passive thing. For example, we've had many of these whites, when they've been on the program, they can give us endless lists of the types of privilege mm-hmm. they have as a white mm-hmm. woman or a white man. Endless mm-hmm. lists. When I ask them, okay, pause, you've given us number 153 on the white privilege list. Can you give us one way that you have practiced racism? The crickets come out every time. Nobody can even get number one on this is how I practice racism. And to me, that's the sort mm-hmm. of thing where I say, you're not pretending, you're lying. Because there's no way, if mm-hmm. you're a white person and you've been on this planet for 20 years, you can't tell me a way that you've practiced racism. I think that, in my view, I'm sinister enough to think, just using logic, that I think whites deliberately use terms like privilege or microaggressions. They use these terms to obfuscate. What we're talking about is domination, power, and terrorism to totally wage war on non-white people. That's what this boils down to when we're talking about these policies and how this plays out in life. I don't think privilege is the most accurate term to describe if we're talking about dominating people, dominating in a hostile mm-hmm. manner, in an unjust manner. I don't think privilege is the best word mm-hmm. to articulate that. Does that make logical sense?
Oh, absolutely. And you're not the first person who made that criticism, right? I think that's exactly correct. And privilege is really a legal term. You know that, right? It's a legal term. And what it meant was, and I guess means in some ways in the contemporary moment, was that to have access to some benefits that others don't. That's what privilege meant in law. To have access to some benefits that others do not. To be privileged. I agree with you that we could use a different word, a word that is more, I think you're looking for a word that's more powerful. But I think that's what it means, having access to the benefits of dominance. And how do you dominate in a lot of different kinds of ways. There's physical dominance, there is numerical dominance, what you were kind of referring to is, you know, violence. Almost all domination is backed by violence, I think, right? Almost all domination, except numerical, right? You can have a majority and dominate kind of through a majority. And that might have a sort of violence, but it may not necessarily be backed by violence. But sure, we could use more powerful words. We can talk about white supremacy. We can talk about dominance. We can talk about oppression, because all of those are at play here. And we can talk about violence, straight up violence. No qualifier, no anything, just violence, because that is what this system has used to maintain control over this territory, right? These are really colonial settlers, right? Violence to both gain control over this territory and maintain control over the territory and all of the people who are here. Yeah. Stronger words. Yeah. White privilege is kind of a term of art and perhaps a past one. But you make that criticism, I take it. I think that and others have made it. It's almost a confusing term.
Mm, wow. What and this was a question that Dr. Curry was hoping that we could slip in. You talked a little bit at the beginning of the program about some of your earlier thoughts and conversations that you were having with regards to intersectionality and whatever privileges black males might have on the basis of gender and then being mistreated as victims of racism. He wanted to know, can you kind of describe how maybe some of the shifts in your understanding or your thought, your view on this from where things started to where you are now?
Okay. Two different thoughts. So, Ramon, the second thought is really about some of this later work that really talks about agency, and I want to get there. But I want to start with this notion of male privilege. I guess I would probably disagree with Dr. Curry a bit, although I couldn't give you concrete examples. I do think that black men do have access to some limited form of male privilege. That they benefit from male domination. And so male domination, the concept is, I think, very similar, that men as a group subordinate women as a group. It would be how I might start. And black men, though this is much more problematic, and there are a lot of other intersecting factors and axes of power in how they exercise that privilege or the extent to which they can use that privilege. I do think they have male privilege. So I was listening to his quote in the beginning, and I thought about him. I had this argument with Derek Bell over one of his narratives. I think it was probably the 27th year. He and I got in a really big argument about this. And yes, and Patricia L. Collins makes this point as well. She says a lot of times what you see in terms of employment, and I'm going to go back to the employment context, in terms of employment, that that you find a higher percentage of unemployment of among black men because black women could always get a job as a domestic. So they, a lot of times, had jobs where a percentage of black men did not have jobs. But their jobs were kind of on a lower rung. They were had lower wages. They were often service jobs and that sort of stuff. I think we see that kind of throughout the society. So when I think about the legal profession, for the longest time, and I think that is shifting now some, a bit, not sure, but certainly at the time I was having this argument with Derek Bell, it was very clear, and I did the research and brought it to him and said, you know, so if you looked at the legal profession, look at kind of who are the stars in the academy. And go through a lot of different fields. What you will find is those stars, those people who, for whatever reason, have been kind of allowed to rise in those arenas, they have been men. They have been men. So when we look at kind of the highest echelon, if black people are present, then it's men who are black men who hold those positions, not black women. Now, that may be shifting some, but that was certainly the case at the time. While more women, you might have actually found more women in the academy and all of those really kind of fancy spots and fancy places and with much higher salaries, not $3,000, but much higher salaries, what you saw were black men. So I think you do see kind of structured privilege in that that sort of way. I also think, and I talk about this a little bit in the article I did, which is now 10 years old. I think there's some newer research and some newer thinking on this. But in terms of black communities, I think that black men and black male issues are oftentimes centered to either the exclusion or at least to the kind of limitations or diminishment, that's the word I guess I was looking for, to black women's issues. That black male issues in black communities are often centered. And that's a function of male privilege. When you look at the few institutions that are in our communities, I think what you will find, and that too may be shifting some, is that you will find at the higher level, black men. Function of male privilege. So I think that is there. Now, is it as robust, if you can use that kind of positive word, as in white communities and other communities? No. And is it limited and restricted? Is this kind of access to male privilege restricted by the society for black males? Of course it is, on the one hand. On the other hand, when we talk about victimization and vulnerabilities, are black men uniquely vulnerable in some sorts of ways? Absolutely. That's absolutely true. Both of those things are true. And so when we start talking about complexity, then we have to start talking about complexity. And so when we go back to the, racial profiling and stop and frisk, that's kind of dominated really by black males. So black males, for a variety of reasons. One is, you know, who do you trust, as John Calmore would say, in anonymous space, in public space. Men generally are seen as more threatening, and black men are seen as particularly threatening. Therefore, there's a lot more surveillance of black male activity. It doesn't matter what they're doing. You know, if they're, you know, singing a song or minding their business, a lot more surveillance of black men than there is of black women. I think that's absolutely true. That's what I call gender racism. But both of those things seem to be true to me. And black males are uniquely, just like black females. I mean, I think all of these subgroups have, when we take a multidimensional viewpoint, what we will see is different groups are oppressed and structured and constrained in different sorts of ways. So I think that's there. I don't know if that begins to answer that question. But that's what I think.
It does, and this is why I'm so glad that you indulged me to give me a definition for privilege, because that helps, mm-hmm. you know, at mm-hmm. least for me, it's very, mm-hmm. very helpful. So access to benefits of domination, you know, I'm thinking of black males, and I am mm-hmm. a black male, so, you know, this could mm-hmm. be my bias, but okay. So access to benefits mm-hmm. of domination, and I'm thinking, okay, so there should be evidence, concrete evidence of black males having mm-hmm. access to benefits of domination. I do not see that exercise like anywhere.
You don't think there's any evidence of access
domination
to male
is
privilege or access to male domination in society? You see no
black
evidence
male?
Of black access to that in any regard? Really?
Well, when you started your response, you said that you mm-hmm. were having difficulties coming up with concrete examples. That was what you said. And then you said, in terms of the academy, which for me, mm-hmm. the academy, I mean, I hope we're not saying that what the employment practices on the academy, that that's like representative, like the limited small number of black people who have a job in the ivory towers, that that's representative of black people on the whole. The vast majority of black males and females are not going to have jobs there or even the opportunity to get a degree. So, I mean, even if they
But keep pushing that. So I would challenge you, in fact, to go look at other sorts of, because this the wage income, the differences between, you know, black women are on the bottom. When we look at wage differentials, it is black men, it's black men, white women. Sometimes they switch back and forth, and then black women. That is pretty consistent. That's not just out of the academy. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you to take a closer look at where those wage differentials are coming from. So that when we think about women are segmented into jobs that are lower paying to begin with.
Okay. Hang on one second, because I did want to get in. I have seen some of those wage chart statistics and what have you. Mm-hmm. I have seen some where mm-hmm. white women are also in front of black white people, period, are in front of all black people,
period.
White females, yeah. white males, right. everybody's in front of black people. That's one in the morning. That's huge, because that's not right. the way that you stated it, but, you know, okay. The next point.
No. I think you ought to go back and look at that, because and maybe that has shifted. Mm. But in fact, and I can't, and I wish I'd have looked this up, because actually I think it's in my book. Because one of the things I had a hard time doing at the time that I was writing the book, because there's always the comparisons are always black men to white men and then white women to black women. Mm. And so we made an effort to look across those categories. And at the time, I think, and I'd have to really look it up, it was white men made the dollar, black men made, I don't know what they made, you know, something like 80% on the dollar. White women made something like 73%, and women, I'm making up these numbers, and black women made like
70%. Well, wait a minute. Since you haven't looked it up and I haven't looked it up, I'm willing to concede that, you know, you could be correct. I'm just saying, I know I have seen statistics where white women are in front of black males. I just wanted to get that stated. That could, I'm not saying it's an error. I'm just, I have seen those studies, but since you didn't look, the point that I did want to get in, though, in the introduction mm-hmm. with Dr. Curry, he said that the amount of money that black males make mm-hmm. that's supposed to be mm-hmm. somewhat higher than black females is so small, and we're in the same area. It's not like black males mm-hmm. make so much more on average than black females that mm-hmm. they're able to go and hang out at Trump Tower and leave black females. That's not the case. Like, they're staying in the same mm-hmm. spot. You're in the same mm-hmm. social circle. It's not enough mm-hmm. to begin talking about this as though for all of this time that we spent on the unearned black male privilege, like, really? It's that substantial mm-hmm. in a system dominated by white supremacy? Like, really?
I heard that quote. I heard that quote. And what he said, I thought, and I'd have to look at it again. He was also subtracting out the men who were unemployed, men who were incarcerated. He was making, I think, a sophisticated analysis. But he was, you know, he was massaging these statistics. And so that, yeah, in certain circumstances, it might be in a family, so certain circumstances might be 3,000, but he was averaging it across the groups. And maybe that's a fair analysis. Maybe that's a fair way of kind of looking at the issue. But I would challenge you to look across industries. And although I think that may be shifting, so I recently heard that black women are quickly becoming one of the highest educated groups in the country. I find that kind of startling. And so that tells me there are some shifts going on. But I would have you look kind of across industry. So I gave you the example of the academy, but these statistics are not based in the academy. That's one point. The second point is this. When I talked about, and you haven't even addressed that, when I talked about community focus and community energy spent a lot around black male issues and male dominance in community institutions, that again is about male privilege. And I think that is real, so much real. Actually, my son wrote a paper on this, that even in the context of Black Lives Matters, even though it was started by three women, two of whom I think are trans women, that the focus very quickly became on police brutality against black men. And some of that might have been legitimate, because I think that black men are, you know, surveilled to a much higher degree than black women. But out of, in the process of that, you have the development of this movement, Say Her Name, because the women who are abused by police were kind of invisible in all of this, even though we know that the incarceration of black women is increasing by leaps and bounds. But the community's focus was really kind of on what was happening to black men. And so I think that is a function of privilege. It's also a function of maybe raw numbers. I would concede that. But I think that's also a function of privilege. That does not mean, I don't know that it has to be either or. I'm not sure we have to be engaged in the sweepstakes, as someone called it, of oppression. I think that what you will find is we are oppressed in different sorts of ways, in ways that are compounded and that impact the entire community, such that you see these other kinds of statistics, right? We have highest mortality rates. We have some of the lowest incomes, that we have, you know, kind of just walk down from health to income to wealth, or we probably at the negative wealth level, to any kind of a social indicator of well-being, we're at the bottom. As a group, that does not mean that we're not differentially treated, that we don't bring our own uniqueness, that we're not oppressed in unique ways based upon kind of our gender or our class and that sort of stuff. All of that is there. And some of it brings privilege and some of it brings disadvantage. Right. So that if we're taking kind of a complex approach, I'm not so sure what the harm is in saying, yes, that Black men in some limited fashion benefit from male privilege. What else would be new?
They also have
some distinct disadvantages, right?
Okay. I just wanted to hop in and give my response to two components of privilege and then the portion that you said about not responding to this alleged unearned privilege that Black males have in the quote unquote community. The first point, just with the word privilege, just for any of our listeners, I've recommended for years, and this conversation would just for me be further evidence. This is why I discouraged the use of the term privilege. I'm talking about the system of racism, white supremacy. I'm talking about power. Just in my view, I just don't see the constructive value of trying to dig through the rubble of our lives and under white power to try to figure out, well, maybe you have a little bit of privilege in this capacity, certainly not enough to reverse all of the terrorism that is being heaped on you and other Black people, but maybe you have a few nuggets of privilege. Like, I just don't see that. And in fact, I said before, I was at the White Privilege Conference, I went to a conference hosted, they have workshops, right? So I went to the workshop with Diane Goodman. This is a suspected racist white female. And she talked, the theme of the workshop was supposed to be finding ways of working against your privilege. And she wanted everybody in the workshop to list different forms of privilege that they had. And I mean, it got to the point, in my view, if we're supposed to be here to talk about white supremacy, which is what the founder of the conference said explicitly, and now we're here and we're talking about, well, I'm 6 feet tall and you're 5 feet tall, so I'm a foot taller than you, so I have height privilege, and you are 45 and I'm 25, so I have age privilege. I mean, that's, I have five shirts and you have two shirts. I have shirt, I mean, that's kind of where this has gotten. And I'm like, this is absolute folly. I was led to believe we were addressing white power and white supremacy, not picking out little bits of ways where maybe I have a slight advantage. Again, nothing in comparison to white supremacy. That's one. The second point, when you talked about the, that's another term that I don't use. If you have a community, you cannot be under subjugation and have a quote unquote community. When you talked about Black males specifically, their issues being addressed. And I've heard that a lot with regards to Black Lives Matter and people saying that people do not address issues like Daniel Holtzclaw when he was former enforcement official, when he was raping exclusively Black females in Oklahoma. I heard it with that case specifically, that this is an example where Black males get all this attention. This happened. He was arrested in August of 2014, which was the exact same time that the crisis erupted in Ferguson. So you have all this attention on Michael Brown and zero, basically, on Daniel Holtzclaw in Ferguson. I would submit that that's true. In my view, that is not an illustration of Black male privilege, because the vast majority of Black males who have a problem with law enforcement or any other aspect of racism are not going to get any coverage, as is the case with most Black females. It just happened to be this incident with Michael Brown that got a lot of attention. And if it's a police incident, these explosive little dramas that people watch and become all fascinated with, I think just the dash cam video, or if it isn't and you have a riot and that sort of thing, it can become attention getting for a while. But these episodes, as you stated in your report, I can just read what you said from progressive black masculinities. It shouldn't be surprising that this happens a lot with black males, because it's disproportionately black males that this sort of thing is happening to. This is your own work in progressive masculinities. You write, common sense explanations suggested that a complex array of social factors such as poverty, racism, the war on drugs, changed penal policies, and culturally specific behavior patterns gave rise to the mass incarceration of black men. Although various analyses weighted a host of factors, to the extent there was a focus on black and brown men, many studies suggested that racism played a part. Black women, however, are also subject to some of these same conditions, including racism and poverty. But though black women are experiencing rising levels of incarceration, their numbers do not begin to compare to those of black men. I just admit it's more likely that this sort of thing is going to happen with a black male. But my question that I wanted to ask, is the interrogation of alleged unearned black male privilege, how is that going to help us permanently neutralize white power racism?
I think that's an excellent question, because I don't think you can do one without the others. So that what I would simply say to you is male supremacy is real. Look around the world. Male supremacy is real. White supremacy is real. Male supremacy is real. Elite power and supremacy is real. Those things are real. And I applaud you for being concerned about dissecting these communities, which is also a term you don't like, but and talking about these nuances. But this is the world we live in. This is what's real. And to me, in order to have a proper set of action steps, you want to do something about it. You've got to have a proper diagnosis. So we need to be clear about what's real and what's happening. That's why I undertook that work, because the explanations that were popular at the time that I wrote that book did not, in fact, I thought, really explain certain phenomena and certain things that were going on in our community. So I undertook that work because of that. That is, we have to be able to explain what's going on in our world. And we've got to be true to that, even if we don't like it, that these phenomena, that certain structures are real. White supremacy is real. It's a global structure. Male supremacy is a global structure and has a much longer history, quite frankly. Then we can't even remember the history. It's so ancient. We don't even know where it came from. But male supremacy is real. And so in the context of kind of this racial hierarchy under which we live now, we find that those things intersect. So it's not just, we don't see white women up there at the top of this hierarchy. We see white men at the top of the hierarchy. We see the intersection of whiteness and white domination, since you don't like the word privilege, and white power and male power and male domination, et cetera. And a lot of forces fighting to keep that in place. We also see that, and I think it was Bell Hooks who came up with the term of something like, Frank Valdez came up with a term that was similar. You know, when we looked at this order, it was, I think she talked about kind of white supremacist capitalism or something like that. You know, she really talked about the intersection of race, gender, class, sexuality, you know, all of those. She listed it in kind of a phrase. I talk a lot about elite white men, elite Anglo heterosexual white men. This is what the top of the hierarchy looks like. That's real. And it's not white women. It's not, you know, they may be up there, But they're not at the top of this hierarchy. And so male domination and male privilege is real. Male domination, or being complicit in the system of male domination, or having some benefits of that, even if that benefit is constrained by racism or heterosexism or whatever, you know, or some sort of class structure, right? So poor black men are not placed in the same sort of space that more elite black men are. That's just a fact. So yes, an elite black man might be stopped in his Mercedes, but I can tell you that poor black men walking on the street and in their cars are stopped far more often, particularly where they are in our very segregated neighborhoods. So those are real. So if we want to talk about how do we start addressing this system of white supremacy, we need to be clear about kind of what's going on. We have to have an analysis that can at least reflect or acknowledge or explore some of these things that make this thing more complicated. Okay. Having said that, so I would say that white supremacy is very much intersecting with male supremacy and also with class status. When we start trying to address how to attack male white supremacy, that we can't do it without taking into account some of these other things that are working. You know, and because a lot of times we'll find ourselves working at cross purposes. So one of the things I argue in that particular article is that, in fact, not so much male domination, but of sexism, right? So the belief that men should have certain kinds of advantages and the practices of sexism actually undermine anti-racist struggle when it happens in our own community. It undermines, it puts us at odds with one another. It undermines the anti-racist struggle. If, you know, you are engaged in what are sexist and classist behaviors and thinking and strategies, that you're undermining the anti-racist struggle. And so we have to be clear in our diagnosis. That's why we're talking about those. That's why I said it's not a sweepstake of some sort, of oppressions, who's worse off, and that is not that. For me, anyway, it's a process of trying to analyze what is actually going on in our communities, and then what do we have to do to put ourselves in the strongest position to fight white supremacy.
Okay.
And fighting white supremacy also means, because those are systems of domination. So if you are against systems of domination, then you're against male domination. You're against male supremacy. If you believe that that domination constrains and restricts, oppresses and harms human potential, then we should be on the same side around domination in its various forms. And so our strategy is probably going to need to address those. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves fighting among ourselves because one faction is trying to dominate or to get some Benny here or there when we really need to be united. So we need to address all of those dominations together, not just one, because the things are interrelated. That's what I would argue.
Okay. I want to make sure we get to some of our callers. We had a couple of people that dialed in to get a quick question in as well. I did want to say, it's not that I don't like the term community or the term privilege. Mm-hmm. It's that I've concluded these are not the most accurate terms to describe, as you just stated, to get an accurate assessment of the problem. I've concluded these terms are not accurate, just looking at the definition and what we have. It's not that I don't like, and I make an effort to point that out consistently, that this is not about like or dislike of terms. The second point, I've also concluded, just following counter-racist logic, you cannot have two supremes. If white supremacy exists, you cannot have white supremacy and then say that black males are victims of white supremacy and black males are participants in male supremacy. That just, to me, is not logical. That just gets to
it
the
may not be logical.
What,
It may not be logical.
That's important. Hang on one second. Hang on one second, because I was talking, and that's if we have a difference of opinion there, that's fine, because I could be wrong. I'm still learning about this as well. That's why I was glad to have you to come on the program to discuss these issues. And Dr. Curry, he had referenced your work as well, but I do try to make an effort, where I do encourage and make an effort to follow logic in dealing with racism, because I have seen consistently that that is one of the tactics of racists to lead us into things that are not logical in how we are conceptualizing and approaching these issues. But some of the folks who dialed in who had a question, again, our guest, Buffalo, University at Buffalo School of Law, Professor Athena Matua, the caller at 6133. Did you have a question for Professor Matua? You should be with us.
Hi, good evening, Gus, and good evening to the guests, Dr. Matua. I have a question about the election. Do you think that Hillary was a superior candidate for black people, knowing that she supported and helped author the 1994 crime bill that tripled the federal inmates, and she also supported Margaret Sanger, who was for population control of our people, and for other racist policies that the Clinton supported. So her type of racism to me is more refined as an attorney, and Trump is more gross and above it. So who do you think would have been a better candidate for us in this election?
There were no perfect candidates in this election. I started off as a Bernie Sanders supporter because I liked a number of his economic policies. And I thought they were policies that would better serve our community. So that's where I started off. But, you know, I'm a pragmatist. And once he lost the nomination, I quickly moved to Hillary Clinton. Now, I've always liked Hillary Clinton. I think that she's been in politics in one form or another for 30 years. And for 30 years, people have been criticizing and condemning her. And I'm not so sure she could ever rise above some of those criticisms, a lot of which I think are false. The ones you point out, however, I think are very much true. And I'm not so sure if I thought that Hillary was going to make much progress on some of the economic issues and even on some of the race and gender issues that I know she knows. I don't know if I thought she was going to make much progress on those. But was she a superior candidate to Trump? Absolutely. She was not going to go down there and build a wall. She was not going to ban Muslims from the country. She was not going to require that they register in some national registry. That just reminds me of Nazi Germany. That they register so people can keep track of them and that sort of stuff. Those kinds of things she would not have done. And I don't think her message was basically and profoundly about exclusion. I just don't think that's true. So as compared to Trump, to me, it's no contest. No contest. Is she more sophisticated and is hers a more sophisticated form of racism? No doubt. But I think also we might have been able to hold her more accountable, assuming she could make some more progress. That is, I'm not so sure we were ever going to give Hillary Clinton the latitude that we gave President Obama. I think we held back a lot on that. And I think we benefited from his presidency, but he could have done so much more. And I have some criticisms of him as well. But anyway, the latitude I think we gave him, I don't think Hillary was ever going to get. And so we might have been able to hold her a little more accountable to her platform and some of the good policies I think she had on her webpage. So between her and Trump, this to me is no contest, really.
No contest. Why is it no contest? I mean, for us, not for other people. I mean, just for the black community.
Well, I don't think, so I didn't list that one, but I don't think that she would, I mean, having assigned on to President Bill Clinton's crime bill and that sort of thing, having kind of agreed with it at the time. I don't think that she would do that during her presidency. In fact, I think she was committed to, so for instance, with regard to Donald Trump, she would not be talking about reinstituting some sort of stop and frisk policy as a kind of national policy. That would not happen. The stop and frisk policy has been very detrimental because we have the highest amount of kind of some people call it an occupation. We have a lot of police engagement in our communities. Stop and frisk policies just put us at risk for harassment and then possibly death and certainly higher levels of incarceration. That's a fact. And she would not have done any of that. So that alone, I think, makes her a much more positive candidate and possible president as compared to Trump. And that, I think that's just one policy. I think there are other policies that she had in place from which we would have benefited from. I think some of her economic policies, though not great, some of her economic policies we would have benefited from. We certainly would have benefited, I think, from a lot of her focus on family and children, so daycares, family leaves, we would benefit from that. Black women would benefit from some paid childcare leave. They would benefit from support of childcare more broadly. Healthcare, I think she wanted to approve Obamacare, just leaving that in place, which we can be assured of will be repealed. We're benefiting from that. We benefited from the Affordable Health Care Act. Absolutely. When it's gone, if we have not understood that, we will understand that because it will be repealed probably. Now, Trump is kind of wavering on when and how, but a voucher system is not, you know, some sort of voucher system is probably going to mean less health care for us. So there's a lot of ways in which I think we would have benefited from a number of her policies that weren't particularly radical and from a number of the policies that she would have continued that President Obama put in place. None of that's going to happen, I think, with a President Trump. And it may not even be because of him personally, but because now Republicans now are in control of all three branches of government. Does that make sense to you?
The caller, 6133, did she answer your question?
Well, I mean, her answer is based on conjecture, and it's not based on what Hillary's done in the past and what policies she supported in the past. So it sounds like you're just saying that you hope that she would have done this and done that. I mean, I like your response, but you didn't really answer the question. But thank you anyway.
Well, yeah, it's kind of based upon her website and her policies, her stated policies. All of it's conjecture, right?
Okay. The caller at 4789. Did you have a question for Professor Matua?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Dr. Matua, I had like two quick questions.
Okay.
The first question is, have you been successful in turning a white college student to not practice racism?
Turning a white college student into what now?
To not practice racism.
To not practice racism. That's a really tall order. I would not claim that. What I would say is that what I have done is had conversations and classes with them that helped raise their awareness of their own biases. I've raised their awareness about what the practices of racism, like some of the practices of racism looks like, what microaggressions look like, what kind of effect they have. I think I've done that. I have raised their consciousness and engaged them and encouraged them to be critical thinkers in terms of how society is structured, and what their own participation has been in it and what it could be in it, right? So this semester I'm teaching a course where we're talking about social impact advocacy. So how do you as a lawyer engage in activities geared toward transformative change? So raise their consciousness is what I would say, and made them aware and engage them in critical thinking. Whether I've changed them, change actually them to the extent that their practices are different. Perhaps, I'm not so sure I will ever know. But people live a long time. So they have to continue to be engaged with these issues in order to really start to change, right? Change is a slow and long process. So for instance, I had an interaction with a gentleman who lived down the street from me, and one of the things he said to me was, "Well, I marched with King." And my response was, "Yeah, that was 50 years ago. What have you done since then? And what has been your engagement?" And at that point, he was talking about boys, very young boys, loitering on the corners at the end of our block. You know, that told me that, you know, this guy has some problems. And he might have been kind of a really progressive, critical, anti-racist thinker at one point of his life, but he probably had not continued those practices. So who knows? I'm trying.
Thank you for that answer. When you were talking about black male privilege, I thought it was telling that you said that, especially about the lawyers, I guess you said that black male is something to the effect of having been allowed to be stars. And I thought that was telling because you said having been allowed. So I guess my question is, it would be awesome if you could define male supremacy, and then I don't know if there's a difference between male supremacy and then black male supremacy, and then also elite supremacy, and then I was hoping that you could sort of finish it off by telling us which one is the most of supreme of those. I don't know, or maybe even add white supremacy in there, and then tell us which one is the most supreme out of all these supreme systems. Thank you.
That's quite a mouthful. Let me try to say. I said aloud. I think I was just being cautious because I think that a lot of times when we find ourselves in these positions. So I'm a law professor. I've gone to great schools. And I think our tendency a lot of times is to say, then Athena is exceptional. I'm not really exceptional. I have a lot of luck. I have strong family support, people who have pushed me up over the hill. I've had been in some right places at the right time. So it's not just all about my hard work. That's what I think I was really hedging against, not just allowed by white people, but allowed by circumstances to kind of be in these places. Such people work hard, but the reality is more complicated than that, I think is what I was doing. In terms of kind of male supremacy, white supremacy, leap supremacy, I think those things are interconnected. I tend to talk about, because it's kind of my specialty, I tend to talk about race, and I'm a critical race theorist. I say that first. And so I tend to focus a lot more on racial structures. But I do think that if we step back and talk about kind of who rules the world, and though that's changing and that's part of the fear that's out there, it is elite white men. And by elite, I mean simply rich white men, rich, wealthy, and men who are in control of, white men who are in control of huge institutions that have lots of resources. These are the people who are in decision-making positions more pervasively than anyone else. So I would say, kind of elite white men. And so that is a thing, and that really is a statement of the intersection of race, white supremacy, male supremacy, and wealth, and control of institutions. So I'm not sure one is more dominant than the other. I think they have different histories. So when we talk about kind of male domination and male supremacy, and we talk about patriarchy, patriarchy predates the rise of Europe. It has a very ancient history. In some ways, it's more acceptable even still to be, it's more acceptable, at least at the level of the superficial, to be sexist than it is to be racist, right? People are more offended if you call them racist than if you call them sexist. I just think those are realities of the world that we live in. The world that we live in is kind of complex. It is not simple. It's not often either or. It's a lot of times and this, and this, and this in equal measure. So I guess I would leave it there. I don't know if that's a direct answer to your question, because you really want me to establish a hierarchy of dominations. And I think in real life, from at least where I sit, and I could well be wrong, all of those things are interacting all the time. So, stop there. Does that get at your question?
Sorry?
Go ahead, sir. Hello? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, no, I guess my question was just like, I mean, it's very simple. Like, I mean, I guess I understand what you're saying, but that they intersect. But which one is more supreme? I feel like you can't have, supreme is a very strong word. It means that you are on top. It means that you are more powerful, that you are more dominant. So you cannot have multiple supremes. It just sounds, it doesn't make any sense to my mind.
I don't know who said that you can't have more than one thing going on at any one time, because, in fact, that's the way life is. We always have multiple things going on. That's just a more complicated analysis, for sure. But
I didn't use the terms things. But at the same time, I don't want to get into like an argument. But I didn't use this term things. I said we were using the term supreme.
Supreme, right. Supreme. And so I would ask you, let me ask you, you answer this, you answer your question. Who, at least up until kind of the current moment or in the current moment, who rules the world? What does that look like to you?
So like one thing that I'm very cautious of is, when I ask like a very simple question, that somebody asks me a question by redirecting it, I feel like you could just answer my question and then we could change the subject to me. But I was sort of asking you the question about supremacy and what is. But at the same time, I don't want to get into an argument. You can just not answer it. That's fine. Thank you.
I tried to answer it. Mm-hmm.
We had one final person. They wrote in. They said they are not in a position where they can speak over the line, but they have been listening. Their two quick questions were, mm-hmm. number one, mm-hmm. Where does Professor Matua think the narrative of white women being allies of black women or black people come from? And how did we, black people, end up buying into that narrative? That's question one.
I think it's a fair enough question. So one way to get at that would be, do we have any allies? And I would say we have allies to degrees. And our allies share some of our concerns and part of our agenda, but they also have their own agendas. And so one could say that we have no allies at all. So another group would be white liberals. Are white liberals our allies? In some ways, I think they are. I think there are a lot of white liberals who have are sympathetic to an anti-racist agenda. They are sympathetic to let me leave that. And so they are allies to a degree. Where they come out with this kind of sympathetic and willing to work on behalf of an anti-racist agenda and notions of white supremacy, their own kind of situation, it's hard to tell. But I do think they are allies. I think that white women at moments have been, not many, but at, have been allies. That is, that they have been more willing to consider sharing the resources and relating to others in humane and decent ways. I think that's real. And so I think they are allies to some degree or another. What about other groups? I think the situation is the same. We share some common interests. I think it's necessary to have allies and to cultivate those allies and to set some common agendas. So it's a narrative, sure. But I also think there's some reality there that we find that maybe not white women writ large, but certainly there are white women who are allies. I think white feminists in some ways have been allies to some degree or another. So that's how I would answer that question. Otherwise, the answer could be we have no allies because you're always going to have different groups that have slightly different agendas.
Hmm. Okay. Her last question, she says, earlier you spoke about 90%+ of black females who voted for Hillary Clinton. What does she read into the fact that Clinton did not thank those same black females who voted for her so heavily, yet she thanked everyone else?
That's interesting. These are tougher questions. I don't know what to, I don't know exactly what to make of that. Because she was clearly aware early on that she had a lot of black support and that she had a lot of black women's support and that, she was, in fact, engaged. And she has always engaged. So I'm a Delta. She was at the Delta Convention, Centennial Convention, a couple of years ago and spoke, I think, in really interesting ways and was very much aware of the issues. That's why I don't doubt that she knows the issues. The question was whether what she was going to be able to do about them and whether she was committed to doing something about the issues that we might think are important. The mothers of the movement, as they are referred to, campaigned heavily on her behalf. And so she was certainly aware that she gained a lot of, she had a lot of support early on from the black community and black women in particular. That she didn't acknowledge that, that's just sad. And maybe not surprised, and I have to think about it, but just sad.
Hmm.
What else can we say? Mm-hmm.
To be expected. We had
maybe not surprising, right?
Skank, that's what I will say. I will use your term.
Oh, my goodness. Don't quote me on that. But I said it. Okay. Fair enough. Mm-hmm.
The person, we had a lollygagger, the person that called in from a block number. Did you have a final question for Professor Fatua?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Lollygagger. I called in late. Oh, sorry about that. I just wanted to thank your guests for coming on because it's definitely intriguing to hear you guys discuss these issues. It's given me a lot to think about. Because at one point when you were talking, I didn't think you were making much sense when you were talking about black male privilege and whatnot. But, you know, just hearing you guys go back and forth, and Gus actually saying that he didn't feel like he might not be making any sense himself. It's just I think that kind of switched my thinking that we do need to think more on some of these issues. So just thank you for coming on and making me think a little bit more than I had expected. And that's pretty much
it. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Grand. Before we let you enjoy the rest of your evening, do you remember Lennon Lacy, Professor Matua?
No, I'm not so sure I do. Name sounds familiar, but cue me in.
The black male in North Carolina in 2014, he was found hanging from a tree suspiciously. This was the same month that Michael Brown was shot, August. Lots of things happened that month, August of 2000.
Lots of stuff. Yes, I do remember that.
They were just doing the... and there was lots of anniversaries this past summer, and that was one that mm-hmm. they were reminding mm-hmm. and blah, 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 all that other stuff. I was just trying to ask people, because a lot of people had even forgot it. It passed. Like, so many things happened that people had kind of forgotten. That one just kind of got lost in the shuffle. It has been a pleasure having you on the program. Folks can check out some of the reports that we discussed this evening, Progressive Black Masculinities, a collection Professor Matua edited and contributed, wrote the introduction, and has the first chapter in the series talking about some of the issues that we discussed this evening. You can go to her faculty page at University at Buffalo and see some of her other work and issues that she regularly studies. Thank you so much for hanging out on the program. Was glad we were able to follow up on another one of Dr. Curry's reference points from his earlier visit. We really appreciate you sharing with us. We'll continue to think about these issues, and hopefully we can have you back on the program down the road.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun. I appreciated it.
For sure, for sure. Lots of regard for black mothers. So take care of the family and yourself. Keep up the outstanding work.
Thank you.
For sure. Good evening, Professor Matua.
Good evening. Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. Reference from Dr. Curry's broadcast that was September of this year, when he was on the program, the segment, the little audio snippet that we heard at the beginning. You can go back if you want to hear the full archive. We talked about Lee Parker, a few other, the presidential election, and the likelihood that Trump was going to be ultimately successful, but you can check that out in the archives. As I stated earlier, we will be here on Thursday. We will have two programs, because that's the holiday, right? So we'll be here. The early broadcast is 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central, and 1 p.m. Pacific. That will be Paul Ifeoma Grant. He'll be on the program live from the United Kingdom, London native. He's been on the program a few times before. That will help out, since people should be able to listen early, since nobody, or I won't say nobody, but a lot of people will have the day off that day. And then with the big time difference, we have to broadcast earlier if we're going to have someone on from, you know, overseas or what have you. He'll be here early. And then our normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace racism. Dial in. Folks should not be working, so you can dial in and discuss these views. Might be interesting if you are at some sort of gathering and people have had their meal and whatever else. I guess they're watching football or whatever people do. And tuning into workplace racism to see what people think, if it resonates in any way with their experiences on the job. But that's Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Friday, Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here Saturday for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And then we'll be here on Monday, almost a week away. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, previously mentioned, the University of Texas, Austin, Abigail Fisher's very university that she felt she got snubbed. Dr. Kevorkian will be here. We will be discussing the British film series Black Mirror. One of our listeners, she commented about this series a month or so ago. on the compensatory call-in. I think she was specifically talking about one of the episodes where a white woman, this series is sci-fi, right? It's like the Twilight Zone. So this white woman, the white woman from The Help specifically, I'll give you her exact name Monday when we discuss all this, but the white woman from The Help, the like explicitly racist white woman who was trying to keep her black help from using her toilet, that white woman specifically is the main character, and she is, everyone is obsessed with social media. And so your job, everything, your housing is about social media and your status on social media. And so it's this white woman, her tale of tragedy, where she gets all of these downgrades and loses her status on social media and, you know, it ruins her whole life. But the interesting component is that pretty much all of the people that are responsible for her loss of social media status are black people. She keeps having all of these interactions with black people, and they immediately go on social media and ding her down. It's almost every single person that she has an encounter with is a black person. That was what sparked some attention. The more that I thought about it, I thought there were a lot of significant things happening both in this episode and the whole series. It's not very long. It's 3 seasons, but they have like 3 episodes in a season. So it's not, I mean, reading is way more important than watching television, but it's not a whole lot of viewing. And I think a lot, or it's not, I think to me, it's very flagrant. A lot of these episodes are directly about racism, white supremacy, I mean, explicit, right? That's a central part of the plot. But Dr. Kevorkian will be here next Monday to discuss the series. I think it got picked up by Netflix in season 3, so I think it might be gaining popularity. I don't know if people have seen it, but if you want to check out an episode or two to prepare, that will be coming up on Monday. With that, if folks had anything they wanted to get in before we get ready to wrap up, we can make time for that. Dr. Curry, thank you for the reference. He contributed a few questions that I got in as well as we progressed with the program. If he was listening right on, Dr. Curry can drop a line about his thoughts on the exchange, since his name did get mentioned a few times. He might even have been listening live. Right on. Next, let's see. I mentioned Lennon Lacy. I have heard that presentation before about the disproportionate amount of coverage in terms of black male victims in comparison to black female victims. I think we talked about that quite a bit back in the summer of 2014, around very issue that was brought up today. Daniel Holtzclaw, a convicted rapist, former enforcement officer in Oklahoma, and the very small amount of attention that that case got in comparison to, like, you know, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, things that were happening at the same time, at the same year. And I just submit the same thing that I said back then, the same thing I said on the program today. The vast majority of black victims, regardless, black males, black females, you're not going to get a lot of attention. I think that's very clear in terms of what happens in the system of white supremacy. The vast majority of black people, whether it's an incident with enforcement officers or a banking problem, being denied a loan, or discrimination, what they call discrimination on the job, or anything else, the vast majority of these incidents do not become a big deal. And as I stated, you know, earlier, I think with regards to enforcement officers, those type of incidents become a big deal just because that has been popular for a long time to gripe about the police, particularly now when you have the age where it's cell phone video and everything. That can become a great reality series to watch, which, you know, I've submitted consistently. That's about the size of it, really, where people can watch and hashtag and do all that for a week. And just about the same type of thing happens almost predictably, where it's just another black person is killed and nothing is done about it. Black male, black female, disproportionately, this does happen to black males. So if it's a policing incident that gets a lot of attention, just by the numbers, it is more than likely going to be a black male that's getting attention for this. And in my view, that is not an illustration of black male privilege. That's kind of macabre if it is. But just in my view, that I do not assess it in that way, particularly because I don't believe that it's black males that are the ones that are producing that attention. If I thought that black males were able to get on the phone and access white, or access domination, the power of domination, to demand that the New York Times and the BBC and Al Jazeera and CNN and NPR get there immediately and cover the incident from their perspective, to the world, then I would say, oh, okay, yeah. If they're able to mobilize, that's not what I see happen at all, just for white-dominated media and or Don Lemon or whomever else to come in and put up pictures of them making a gang sign and scowling at the camera to say that they, you know, were strong. That's just my view. Some of these are the exact same things that I said back in 2014. And I would also just admit, Dr. Curry, I think he did say when he was on the program that he, as a professor, has come forward with research saying, you know, hey, black males are being, you know, mistreated. I got this new data. I've been a scientist about it. And it is not, you know, yes, let's go promote this. Let's go, you know, take this to the world. And lots of enthusiasm. He said consistently that's not been his experience. Dr. Smith, we just had on the program last week from the University of Utah. He made the point about you've had pretty vocal and justified criticism of what they call hip hop music by a lot of black male artists for the misogyny and debased contempt commentary on black females. He said a lot of that stuff has a lot of derogatory comments, commentary directed at black males. Where's the assessment of how hip hop music adversely impacts black males and the way that we think about processed black males? Where is that commentary at? And he said that you're going to find comparatively little. I think even I might not be doing him justice. I think he said he hadn't found any commentary talking about the way that hip hop degrades black manhood. He said he hadn't found any. And he said that's not even the point. Even if you can find one or two, it's going to pale in comparison to the amount of scholarship on how it impacts black females. The most important point beyond anything, again, I could be wrong. I am still learning, but just in my assessment, this would just be another illustration of the point I've made for a long time. I am not talking about privilege. I'm not talking about white privilege. I'm not talking about black privilege, male privilege, young privilege, attractive privilege. I am talking about white power that trumps everything. Either that's true or it's not. That's not my assessment that you have multiple systems of supremacy. As I stated on the program, that is not logical. My submission would be if you have those multiple systems, they should not be called supremes. This is not, unless Donna Ross is in the building, we do not have supremes. You have, in my view, it would make logical sense and it would keep down confusion if we don't call these supremes. We just say that we have multiple systems of oppression and come up with a title that adequately explains that. If we say that white supremacy exists, I submit that trumps everything. And I submit that, in my view, I don't see where it makes logical sense to try to dig in a system of white supremacy to see where victims of that system, where they have quote unquote privilege, that just, and particularly, like I said, if we're attaching it to a definition of having access to powers of domination, I just do not see that evidenced, even in the illustrations, the examples that were given. I don't see black males with access to domination where Michael Eric Dyson or Dr. Curry can just, you know, walk onto any Ivy League campus in the world with, you know, and say, hey, I am going to get tenure up in here. I have unearned male privilege or access to male supremacy, and I'm going to get my cushy spot. I have not heard that. In fact, I think we just had Dr. Smith on the program talking about the trauma and terrorism that black males face in an academic environment. And I still go back to what I said on the program. I think you have such a minute number of black people, male and female, in that academic space anyway. To me, that again is just not representative of unearned black male privilege in a system dominated, where the overall theme to me seems to be unequivocally white power, white supremacy. With regards to the community aspect of it, I think that was touched on also in terms of black males, quote unquote, being in positions of leadership. I've just taken the position, the leaders of black people are white. You might have black people, black males, black females, anyone can be showcased. I think white people can show you better than I can tell you what they do to black leadership. And I will stop there and just, again, I just have not seen, and I could be in error, I'll continue to process and think, I just have not seen where assessing this problem, conceptualizing this problem, where we begin to look at victims of racism, and then trying to say that they have, quote unquote, privileges. I just don't see that where that helps us in dissecting this system. I could be in error. I would encourage folks to think about it. Follow the logic. That's what I would say consistently. Follow the logic. Follow the logic. Follow the logic. We are united, independent about how we're going about doing this. But to me, that just doesn't make logical sense. I don't even talk about white people as having privilege, much less talking about black people, male or female, as having privilege. But I could be in error. If any folks have any thoughts they want to get in before we get ready to conclude, feel free. We will not be doing our 3 hours, so be Johnny on the spot. Again, no lollygaggers. If you have any commentary you want to make sure you get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think I might have been getting a delay or something. I was listening online, so I don't know. When you say lollygaggers, I didn't hear anything, any like announcement of the time or anything like that. So I didn't want to just say that because I don't know if I was getting a delay or not. But yeah, I was thinking I was going to think more on it. Like, I agree with some of the things you were saying, but it seems like you don't hear these types of conversations like very often, like the complexity of like how you talk about racism, white supremacy, like, or counter racists talk about racism, white supremacy. So you get a lot of like what she was saying, like the point, like things that she was saying, you hear that more often than you know, how you speak. So I don't know, it just made me think, like, we have to maybe bone up on our understanding of that position that she's taking, so we can maybe bring some clarity to it, because it was kind of confusing at one, you know, when she was talking about black male privilege. It's like it was kind of like she didn't have the evidence, and even stated that she didn't have, you know, concrete evidence, but she thinks that there's black male privilege. So yeah, it was interesting. It was an interesting program. So, oh, I did want to ask her a question. Well, I didn't want to ask her because just listening to what she was saying, I didn't know if she would be able to answer it. But what do you make of the, like, contradiction of these white females? I mean, they say that they're, you know, there's misogyny, but at the same time, they don't seem to vote their interests. There's a lot of things that they do that contradicts them saying that there's, you know, that they're being oppressed.
I think white people in general are, I mean, white lies matter. They are extraordinary at deceiving us. I think white women, yes, white people in general, they fight amongst themselves. Yes, white women have been mistreated and denied access to having, you know, the same amount of power as white men at times and places in the system of racism, white supremacy. Even white men fight with other white men about how the plantation is going to be run and who has more power. All of that is true. None of that negates their primary concern and devotion is to the maintenance of global white power. And I think just a lot of times, I think that gets minimized or out and out refuted, where a lot of times, I'm not saying Professor Matua, but just in general, a lot of times that gets discarded, misrepresented, minimized, or just, you know, they go the exact opposite, that it gets articulated as white male patriarchy, white male supremacy, and white women are articulated as victims or, you know, unwilling accomplices of some sort. And I reject all of that. That's not, in my view, it doesn't make logical sense. You could not have a system of white supremacy without white women being totally on board and dedicated to this above and beyond anything else. And the record is clear. They demonstrate this on a regular basis, not just, you know, from an individual perspective, from a collective perspective. I appreciated her, bro. I thought that was just really great commentary when she was talking about the affirmative action bit. Tim Wise, interestingly enough, the infamous Timothy Wise, he has an article that breaks that down in great detail that we talked about when he was a guest on our program in 2007 about that affirmative action thing, where he says the same, and he says exactly what I'm saying. Great illustration of white women above and beyond anything else. He said the same point, which cannot be said enough. White women, far and away, the dominant beneficiaries of affirmative action. So what? We're not supporting it. Forget it. It maybe helps the Negroes, or just the white collective right now has decided that that's not what we're doing. So even though this is something that has been personally beneficial to me or to us, white women as a collective, we're going with our racial interest. I think a lot of times we get confused into thinking that white women, that they're at war with white men and they're all about their sexism agenda, what have you. I think just a lot of times in general, we get confused into thinking that white people have greater conflicts with each other than they really do. They will fuss and fight and even kill each other. Do not ever think that that means that there is some sort of disruption or divestment from them being committed to dominating black people. That's what I think. That's why I think that that continues to happen, even being surprised about that sort of behavior happening from white women, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, and it's very interesting. I think people need, you know what I wanted to ask you, what do you think about, like, nobody talks like counter-racist, like when you hear, when you listen to the cows and stuff like that, you don't hear people just in general conversation with each other and whatnot, they don't talk like what you hear on the cows, you know, even from the callers. Do you think that there's possibly some type of what would you say, like, there's some, like, limitation, I don't know the word to use, but I'm saying, like, do you think that there's some kind of problem with the fact that it seems like the people, you know, like yourself, counter-racist and Neely Fuller, speak in a way that absolutely, like nobody even talks like that, like, it's like we're speaking a totally different language. What do you think about that? The implications of that and the message that we're trying to get across.
Right now, just I think racists, or it's not even I think, logic and evidence suggests overwhelmingly racists have done a very good job of controlling. Number one, they recognize the importance of language and words and how we articulate this problem. They understand that the verbal technology of our conquest, i.e. Kwee Arma's brilliant phrasing, they understand that. And so they invest a lot of time. Timothy Wise on white privilege, Dr. Peggy McIntosh, they understand the importance of language. These are your tools. These are your weapons in some instances. So, hey, if we can use terms like white privilege, if we can use terms like microaggression, if we can use terms that obfuscate, where we're not even saying white supremacy anymore. We're saying everything else but that, bigotry and prejudice and racial animus and racially insensitive. They have all these other terms where we're not getting directly to what it is. They understand that that is massive when you're using terms that incorrectly convey the concepts and the problem that you're trying to solve. I think that was something that was broached in the program. I agree that is going to make it very difficult for you to solving the problem. I think a lot of victims of racism, I don't think we have adequately grasped the importance of words and really making an effort to really be definitive and to invest great care in refining the words that you use to articulate racism, white supremacy that are very important. I don't think enough of us have grasped that and thought about the way that just the terms that you use, they shape your arguments and how you think about this problem and going about trying to solve it. I think that's huge. I think there's a lot more work to be done just in really emphasizing that. It's not saying that you need to sound exactly like me in articulating racism, white supremacy, but it does say that words are very important and that we should, you know, have thought it. I think even when I asked about the definition for privilege, which I hope that's something that's not lost. If you ask someone, you know, what do you mean when you say whatever the term is, I'm very cautious about getting an example. If you want to give an example, that's fine. But we should still get a, you know, what do you mean definition? We should still get that because it can be very challenging, sometimes impossible to move forward with a concept if you don't have a firm definition. If I ask you, you know, what do you mean when you say car and you just point to a Volkswagen, that might make it difficult for me down the road if I should see something else on four wheels, but it doesn't look like a Volkswagen. I might have difficulty in applying this term moving forward. Make sure you get a firm definition, but that happens a lot where people are using terms and talking about racism where they don't have definitions. People are using terms that are maybe not the most accurate terms to describe this problem. Counter-racism is supposed to be working against that. Obviously, we are failing, so we need to do a lot more work there, really just emphasizing that and why that's important and just recognizing the power of just the words that are used when we talk about this problem. I stated consistently, this is not white privilege. This is about power. Racism, white supremacy is about power, not privilege. That's why I did the rewind this past weekend. Desmond Cole made that exact point, a journalist up in Canada on a news talk segment on CBC, that, you know, we should move away from that way of conceptualizing this problem as privilege. This is about white power, white domination. I will halt there. We had two other folks that dialed in. I'm not even sure they got to ask a question of Professor Matua. The caller at 2045, and I guess the person, you might be on a vote line or something else. Did you all have questions or observations you were going to make? I can hear both of you. I guess if you, the caller.
I'll wait.
Okay. The other caller, I think you have.
I'm sorry, Gus. Greetings to you, Gus. Thanks, brother, for letting me go. Real quick, I just wanted to sum up what I heard from the guest, Matua. Is that her name?
Matua.
Matua. I very well spoken. Somewhat attractive to me. I seen her picture. Very, you know, stand up ish, like dignified. She has a dignified appearance to me. That makes sense. So, and as I said before, well spoken, very educated. But I just listening to the conversation and listening to what she was saying, I disagree with the fact that. I do agree that males do get preferable treatment in some aspects, you know, with jobs and just the whole history of we're in a patriarchal society, you know, male dominant society. But it just always goes back to ground zero for me, you know, if there's not a lopsided amount in the population, as far as black people, there's just as many males as it is females. Black males die, you know, at a higher rate, incarcerated at a higher rate in a society. In a society where we have privilege, these things wouldn't be happening at such a higher rate to our counterparts, to me. And like I said, ground zero. I see more of my counterparts, black women, get more preferential treatment when it comes to getting stopped by the police, getting into incidents with other authoritative figures and things like that, with jobs as well, and employment. So running the household, so it just to me it seemed like she was speaking, you know, maybe what she was studying or what she thinks she knows, but putting it in practice. She was saying something about that too, bad memory. But practice, seeing it, actually seeing it and living it, we definitely don't have any privilege as black males, and. I wanted to ask you, you summed it up with how you feel about that. So, as I said before, thanks, guys. Thanks for this show, always. And I'll mute my line.
For sure. Just before I get to the other caller, I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. There is a higher rate of black male unemployment than black female unemployment across the board, according to their statistics for men 20 and over in comparison to black females 20 and over. I can post the link. You can look for yourself. But that's for me. I just want to emphasize again, for me, that's totally irrelevant. I have no idea, in my view, and I could be completely wrong, whether it's, you know, I mean, I don't know if that means that black females have unearned privilege. I just don't see how any of that helps us neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. I cannot emphasize enough. At the end of the day, the people that are most responsible for all of this are not black people, male or female. They are whites. All of this should be on them in solving this problem. And again, they can switch it around whenever they want to. Maybe today, black males get more jobs. Maybe tomorrow it's black females. Maybe the next week it's neither one of you. I mean, I just think that makes more sense. But again, I could be in error. The caller from 2045, did you have commentary, question, observation?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. How are you?
Right, poorly.
Yes, sir. I agree. When I was listening to you, I had kind of an epiphany, so to speak, but I was hard-pressed to think of when I listened to music very, very little as far as the radio stations are concerned, and I watch very little TV, but the sporting events, whether it's football, basketball, I mean, you know, the DJ, they're playing music that's, you know, basically from our genre, and I'm just hard-pressed to figure out if anybody or you knows any song that a white person has sung that is basically saying, you know, yeah, I'm going to have a relationship with your wife or your girl, and I'm going to send her back to you and do this and do that. I just can't figure out any song that a white person has sung that implicates that suggests that or brags about that. And I mean, I'm really perplexed because, I mean, I know that they control the message, but at what point do we realize that, this is definitely an intricate plan, and I'm just trying to figure out if anybody knows of any song that a white person has sung about the types of things that we're speaking of. And I haven't seen any, big pop star, big white star. Who's the new star, like the new white person that's, you know, killing the charts? It's all black people, and I'm perplexed, man. I just wanted to get your feedback on that. And I'll move my line.
Oh, okay. I don't consider myself to be an expert on music or much of anything else. I can say that I know that there are many whites who have made songs about all kinds of things, unless my memory is in error. I think Eminem made a song about killing the mother of his child and stuffing her in a chunk. So, I mean, whites certainly have made all kinds of songs talking about, you know, killing people and, you know, killing their wife. And, you know, if it's just debauchery in general, I think they have done quite a good bit of that as well. I'm thinking of, you know, different types of the hard rock and punk rock and gore and all that.
And then, yeah, I may be ignorant because, I mean, well, Eminem, I'm talking about different genres. I mean, like a country, I've never heard a country song that's saying that, you know, he's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess, I'm sure they're there. Movies. And I'm not
even if they aren't songs, they certainly have made all kind. I mean, they have made movies about, you know, I'll pay you $1 million to sleep with your wife and then, you know, joke about it afterwards. They have made movies like that. So, I mean, hey, I don't think I think whites have done more than their share of any sort of debauchery or, you know, just vile act, making that into a song or a little ditty or a movie or a TV series or whatever the case. They have done quite a bit. Isn't Dexter a serial killer where he's trying to have sex with his sister? I mean, you know, they're all over the place.
And this proposal or something like that it was, yeah. indecent proposal. He asked to make love to that guy's wife. Or yeah, but okay, I mean, it's just like that's all we talk about in our music is money and sleeping with other people's women. And, I mean, it's just such a – and if you don't present that material, you won't get the deal. And we keep just going to the – we keep walking up to their game and wanting to play it. And at some point, we have to walk away from that game. And I don't know. Thanks for taking my call, Gus, man.
Yes, sir. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, everything else will confuse you. Hopefully, as we get more people to have a better understanding, we can make better decisions, our use of time and energy. Anybody else? Observation or a quick question they wanted to get in before we wrap things up last minute or so? Oh, we did. One of our listeners, she did point out the word fair was used a lot on the program today. Always think that is significant as well. Very, very, very good catch. I would also say as well, I think that exchange would have been a little different if I was talking to a white person and they were trying to convince me about that whole conversation would have sounded different if it was a white person trying to convince me of black privilege in any way, shape, form. If they had started, a white person had started by saying, now I can't think of concrete examples of black male privilege, man, way, way different conversation. It would have been a way different exchange. But I mean, that it wouldn't have sounded anything like that. Anybody else have a quick observation or question they need to get in before we conclude?
Can I be heard really quickly?
Yes, sir. Good comment as well about the word allowed about black males in the ivory towers.
I just wanted to tell the gentleman that was just on concerning, I guess, Dr. Kevorkian coming on next Monday, that Black Mirror, that season, I've only watched season one, which is like 3 episodes. If he watches that, then he'll have enough material to go forever. I mean, the whole thing is about just debauchery, about sex. I think the first episode, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has sex with a pig. So that just starts you off. So yeah, I guess that was my comment. Thank you.
Absolutely. Really interesting series. If you check it out, even it's sci-fi, like it gets compared to The Twilight Zone frequently. And The Twilight Zone, I had a listener, they said they felt like they were dating themselves because they said they watched The Twilight Zone. I was like, man, come to the 21st century. They have Netflix now. I mean, you can just go on your computer and watch anything or your tablet or whatever and just, you know, watch series from any time. So, I mean, you can be a fan of a series that, you know, was on before you were born. But case in point, The Twilight Zone, which was on before I was born. I have watched it, and a lot of the, well, I won't say a lot, but they did address racism in The Twilight Zone in more than one episode. Some pretty interesting viewing if you want to check it out. But Black Mirror gets compared to that frequently, and I'm a fan of sci-fi anyway. Just some of the technique, because it's supposed to be about technology, and this is where it's great to have Dr. Kevorkian on, because I'm interested to see if he thinks that that's just a metaphor for talking about the angst that whites have, that Professor Matua mentioned, the angst that whites have about racism. But it's presented as an angst about technology and not in a Terminator way, in a social media, you know, something that is seen as kind of benign, like just being on Facebook all the time and status updates and that becoming more perverse. Matter of fact, they have a different episode. This is season two, where this black, or it's a non-white female, they tell her that everyone has been programmed, and so they just walk around with their cell phones and video record people all day long. And so that's what she goes outside, and it's just the whole town. The people won't talk to her. They just got their cell phones out recording. And so it's the craziest thing, and you have to watch it. It's directly connected to racism, in my opinion, but it just presents a lot of little tidbits like that. Things you wouldn't, I think it's sometimes it's done in such a subtle manner, like they have a different episode. This is in the first season where they have a device. It's a really small implant that you can get, and you can get like immediate video replay of your point of view for everything that you see. Right. So as you go out and you talk to people and hang out, it's like you have constant seamless recording that's, you know, you have a hard drive and you can replay it for yourself and watch it, right? Just it'll be just on your like retina, or you can link it and put it on a screen so you can like play back like last night when you were at the club or this morning when you were, I mean, it's crazy. So they have this technology. The guy goes to the airport, right? And in the screening, he says, okay, play back your last 24 hours. So to get on the plane, they have to review the last 24 hours of your life. And then he says, okay, play back the last 6 months. And they play it back, and then they let him get on the plane. And that's not even connected to the plot of the film, but just little things like that. Like, at least for me, very interesting to think about that within the context of racism, white supremacy, and particularly technological advances, how all of their technology just gets used to further strengthen the system of white supremacy. Can you imagine that sort of technology as a black person? Like, okay, they have this computer chip, you can get it, and you can, you know, review the last year, the last 2-3 years of your life. You can have it all backed up, you can replay it, you can share it, you could get this technology, but you get stopped by the police. Now, they say, we're going to look at the last 3 years of your life, and maybe we'll copy it. We'll have it stored on a hard drive somewhere. We'll have total video replay of everything you did, like when you went to the bathroom, who you had sexual intercourse with. I mean, just to think about as it goes. But really interesting, and racism is at the center of all of it, I contend. It'll be interesting coming up this Monday. 909, anything else you wanted to get in before we wrap up today's broadcast, or anything quickly?
Yeah, I wanted to thank you. Oh, I did have something, but before I just want to quickly thank you. I feel sometimes I'll be feeling like you're putting in so much work, and then we keep you a little longer than you wanted to be on. And so I just wanted to say, man, you know, I'm about to be really busy, so I don't know if I'll be able to listen to the cows, but I just wanted to say, man, you're doing an excellent job, man. And some of my observation is that just listening, the dialogue and conversation is going to get more and more confusing, and I just see that the lack of understanding of grammar, logic, is going to be a real problem as, you know, as we go along. It's going to get more confusing, so people don't seem, I don't know how to say it, but I think an intense study of logic, grammar, needs to happen, because it's not getting any easier to have these conversations. It's only getting more convoluted and illogical. So if we had that type of device where you can, you know, see your last 6 months, which I try to do as far as journaling and stuff like that, we waste a lot of time. We waste a lot of time, and it's not helping us at all. Please believe me, man. Like, one of my observations is just listening to people, man, and it's not coherent. So I just wanted to just make that point. Like, thank you, and I hope people bone up on, you know, their time and get their logic understanding down, because I don't see people having a grasp of logic at all.
Follow the logic. Very important recommendation. If folks listen to the archive, if you listen in and, you know, want to share your thought, write in, or if you want to share, I guess you could do it on the compensatory call-in coming up this weekend as well. Feel free to do that as well for people who have opportunity to listen to the podcast once it has been uploaded. You can always get the archives, iTunes, Stitcher, we're on Blueberry, we're obviously at Black Talk Radio Network. You have lots of options if you want to get the downloads of any of the archived content, and you can always listen at Tune In Radio online. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. With that, thanks for everyone tuning into the program. Again, congratulations to Dr. Curry, his award or nomination for an award. I hope he gets it. Great job. Keep up the scholarship. And thanks for the reference for Professor Matua's work. Great having her on the program. Also, really appreciated her commentary on discretion. That was great, as well as her commentary about consent. I might have to make a sound clip of that for Dr. Rasayan. That's something else as well. I think that's important. I hope demonstrated, to say that all the time, in terms of being patient and even when there's not agreement amongst victims of racism, which is often, I would say pretty much every time, going to be the case, because I don't know anybody that I have 100% agreement on these concepts. But you can discuss it in a courteous manner without being vulgar and cursing and, you know, good Sambo. And I mean, that's totally ridiculous and not helping us solve this problem at all. Just being able to have calm dialogue, you share, you listen without interrupting, you let the person share their view and think about it, because none of us, you know, has solved this problem. So we all have room to think and consider if we, you know, could be in error, if we just made some miscalculations or what have you, sort of rethink. So, you know, I'll be doing that myself to rethink, make sure I'm not in error with some of the conclusions that I have drawn. But just courteous dialogue. Really glad we can have her on the program. And if Dr. Curry listened, hope his views were not misrepresented or mangled. Hopefully he'll let us know how the dialogue went if he checked it out. Anywho, we'll be back twice Thursday. You can tune in if you are not going to work. Tune into the program. We'll be here twice. Paul DeFami Grant, early program, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, and late 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, workplace racism as usual. Drop us an email if you get confused, have gripes, complaints, guest suggestions. You can't find something in the archives. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I've stated that consistently. You never know when today will be the day. I can't believe I forgot to mention, they put a billboard up in Oklahoma City. The Daniel Holtzclaw, that was on my mind. They put a billboard up that said, maybe he didn't do it. Some firm, they're doing a documentary to suggest that there might be evidence that maybe he is innocent. The it being him being convicted of 18 various counts of sexually terrorizing exclusively black females. But we'll talk about that more as we proceed this week. We certainly have been talking about that case a lot over the last 2 years. Anyway, as I was saying, sobriety would be best. You never know when today might be the day that you are pulled over by Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no. Whites are dangerous. We should keep that in mind at all times. Racism, white supremacy is war being waged against black people at all times. Our behavior should reflect that at all times. The seriousness of this problem, I don't think consuming cannabis, alcohol, cigarettes, any other narcotics, I don't think that is going to put us in the best position to successfully neutralize racism. I haven't seen any evidence to support that so far. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.